I'm your guest host, Dr. Maroon. I will be interviewing Adam Lowery today. Adam is author of The Cognitive Rampage, a Dose of Authentic Revelation book. He holds a master's in mental health counseling and is a certified life coach and health nutritionist. Adam is host of the Cognitive Rampage podcast, reaching 250,000 people each week. And the forthcoming documentary, Chemical Incarceration, is based on his book, Chemical Incarceration, Addicted to the Process. Adam, thank you for spending this interview time with us today and sharing your thoughts with your audience.
Well, I appreciate you hosting the show. I appreciate that even more and taking time out of your day to talk to me about a book. So that's, I think you're doing the favor here. So thank you.
Well, and that's where we want to start today is with your just published book, The Cognitive Rampage, A Dose of Authentic Revelation. And we want to start with, who is this book for? Who did you write this book for? And how is this book going to affect them when they read it?
Big deep breath. No, that's a long answer. I think what sparked it, I'd have to go back to what sparked the whole notion before I could talk about, you know, the book itself. You know, I was working in treatment facilities and rehab facilities at the time, and there were very limited paths to better. And I don't know, for me it was an atrocity. I couldn't stand that. With all the technology, the research, everything I just learned through school, all of this, I'm like, none of this I saw was being applied in any formal, full-on fashion. And it angered me because I had been there once too as a patient, you know, 13 years before that moment. And they were still doing the same thing. And no hatred toward anything directly, that something is there, you know. But at the time, there just needed to be more. And I didn't know what more was. And in the book I referred to, I went to work like John Nash, to quote the movie Beautiful Mind. And remember how he's tirelessly working on the original idea? And in the book, you know, I've come to find that there is no original idea, that we build on each other. Mm-hmm. And that's what I did. And I just started working tirelessly. It took me 3 years to kind of put together what was really first called Transrational Structure Behavior Theory, or TSBT, but it sounded pretentious. And it turned to The Cognitive Rampage after the podcast creation, et cetera. But so I started the fight. It started as a fight. I started the war first against not enough help, or not direct help. Things without drugs, you know, not replacing it with pharmaceuticals. I shouldn't say drugs. That's too vague of a word. Mm-hmm. But it was just a pharmaceutical approach, et cetera. There just needed something more. I don't know. So I wrote the book for what ended up being kind of myself too. Because I realized and revealed, I kept a journal for a long, long time, almost 20 years. And this book kind of helped me realize that I was tracking everything I had been through, you know, normal type things we go through in life and some very not so normal things. And I could see transitions, and I started combining those two. I was like John Nash. I was like a madman. I flew into my cognitive rampage, if you will. It just kind of came out, and I wrote it for those that just needed something else and knew that they could do it, and they had their own willpower, they had belief in themselves, they just didn't know how to, you know. And then as it moved forward to the book, and more academically I was trained and researched and experienced, there was a lot of theoretical approaches and not a whole lot of how-tos. And so I would come across a lot of people and patients that were like, I get the idea, I get the theoretical approach here, but what do I do tomorrow? You know, what's the next?
So a very practical step-by-step translation, is that fair to say, of some intensive theoretical ideas, and you are transforming and translating them into a practical step-by-step approach that people can actually apply in their everyday life?
Yeah, but I stay away from the step-by-step approach because it's too adjacent to the 12 steps. Because I didn't like the idea of steps.
Is it fair to say actionable? actionable approach?
Well, because it's not me per se showing you the way, right? This isn't me saying follow this step, because I don't think anyone can directly tell someone in an authentic fashion that this is directly how you change your life, right? So it was coming more of building a framework for people to allow them to move freely through it. Sometimes if you, so rigidly adjust a step or a phase in life, it's almost like life prediction, as if you know once you finish this and this, then this will happen. But if you live like that, that's the idea of the cognitive rampage, is really not to live so rigidly. That's really the separation from the step idea. I refer to them as kind of moving them through phases. You arm yourself with principles, arm yourself with tools, and then focus on these aspects using these principles and tools. But those principles and tools, you build yourself. So it's your thoughts, your ideas that kind of come from what you believe inside.
Thank you. That's a great recap of the premise and the approach. One of the things that you have done in this book that is wonderful and unusual is you have taken the conversation with your mentors and those folks who you've done a lot of research on. You've taken that conversation out of the acknowledgement section where it traditionally rests, and you've actually devoted an entire chapter to talking about, there are some other things in the chapter, but the primary focus of that chapter is talking about people who have impacted your work, people whose theories and ideas you have drawn upon in order to shape the work that you're presenting for others to develop their own framework and life philosophy, as you call it. So would you talk to us about these founding figures in your own life philosophy?
I really didn't notice that the acknowledgement separation, that I kind of worked it in, because I would be a fool to say that I constructed this book, that this is my theoretical approach even, because most theories are built upon other people's theories and ideas and research. And I probably missed a lot of people. I'm sure I did. So the ones that I hit are ones that impacted my life, because I blur the lines a lot between the separation between my work and my life, because that book is my life's work, because I've lived what is in that book and mixed it with what we call work. But for me, it's been my life. So helping people when I came back from that walkabout became what I wanted to do in some fashion, right? You know, my mentor Leo called it kicking in the front door, and he's always tried to.
I'm sorry, this is Leo.
Yeah, Leo D'Annibal is the first guy I have to mention, because he doesn't have a chapter dedicated to him. Pretty much the entire book is littered with wonderful. We used to call him Leoisms when we'd be around him. Everyone did. He had like 15 people always learning from him. He's freely giving out knowledge. But him and I got close because, I watched him work his craft. And when I was first coming into the field, I watched him work a group. Like he cared, right? But he could move. He could move so quickly and silently, right? And he would always refer to it as coming in the back window. He could come into the psyche of someone's back window and be waiting for them when they're ready. And he used to tell me, Adam, you kick in the front door. And he used to say, it's like you're in this rampage to help them, you know. And part of it would come from my cognitive theory approach. And I still take that approach. I still take that, but I got a dose of him. So I got the pull from him. So the mentors I mentioned are so important. It's a generic term. I know mentors. You can call them whatever you want to. And for me, they're a part of that book. That's why I reference in the book, it's my mentor's wisdom and their mentor's wisdom. Because I quote Leo's father even in there one time, you know, never miss the opportunity to say nothing. Right. There, I took one, right? So, I need more of that, right? So he used to always emphasize this with me. So including, this is pretty, you know, Leo and I worked this together as he developed me secretly through the back window, because I have a problem with authority, as many know. And so he never tried to press the authoritative figure on this is how you do something, as much less, you know how Leo let me do my first group? I loved it. I was interning. We're not even really ready to do a group. Now, the way we went to school, we'd finished all our study. The last thing we had to do was this internship. And so I'm at a pretty intensive dual diagnosis rehabilitation center, and I've been the note taker, you know, maybe 2 weeks, just watching. He'd do
it. And this is, you are working at the dual diagnosis rehab center at this point?
Yeah, I'm going to circle back to the mentors, I promise. And this is part of it. This is, you know, one of the influential moments of something, you know, and I don't talk about this in the book, actually. And anyway, I've watched Leo, and there was another lady there named Deirdre. You know, Deirdre was a by-the-book counselor. Mm-hmm. She basically stood behind me with a whip, and every note that I wrote cracked it, and I had to rewrite it three times. And we terribly did not get along in the beginning. Mm-hmm. But bless her now, because she made me that practical. You know, we still chat once in a while. She moved out. She's very hippie-like. She moved out to the northwest, but retired. But Leo, anyway, watched these two contrasts, very different group runners. Leo would never pass out a handout. No notes. He would just walk in, and he'd always warm up his hands like this. This was his thing. And I always knew something genius about to come out when he started doing this, you know. And I knew this. So it had been about 2 weeks, and I've kind of picked up on this. Well, we've done two groups in the morning. Boom, boom. Or two in the morning. We got a third group and a fourth. We're going to the third group. We're talking like normal. We're about a minute or two before group starting. Everyone's kind of going into the room. And he goes, oh, by the way, you're running this group.
So no notification, just dropping you directly into the water.
Even by my school, like, training, by the practical approach, I'm not, right? You know, but I can, and legally I can. But at the moment, what? Now, I'd had all my schooling. Now, there was just intern. Man, I was like, what? He goes, yeah, all right, hope you're ready. And he walked in. And I'm like, what do I do? That push into the uncomfortable changed me. Because what I did in that moment is I walked and I said, okay, I'm not going to run a group. I'm not going to pass out a handout. And I said, what do I know? What competence do I have that perhaps I can share with them? Not withhold in some pretentious manner of like, so could it be this? What do we think, right? It wasn't this. So I went in, I got infamous with the whiteboard. I got known with the whiteboard. There's pictures floating around of whiteboards where literally looks like John Nash had been working. And I popped open the cap to the marker. I walked in on the whiteboard, and I just went to town. No group introduction, no who am I, who are you, let's just go to work. And I said, this is what I know. I said, what I know is that feelings come from thoughts. Thoughts come from what you believe. And in that moment, it was a summary of cognitive approaches, really. Lights turned on after. All I did was teach what kind of I had interpreted on my own, and I'm a dummy. So I had to take very knowledgeable books and read them a lot to go, that's what they mean, you know, and then I would go down further rabbit holes. But my point is, in that moment, I taught. I didn't do therapy. I taught for a second. And some people came up after and hugged and touched, right? And I did it with a furious passion to help. I didn't sit behind the desk of the group. I didn't sit with my legs crossed in the circle. I moved. I would walk over to a patient as I was talking. Do you see what I'm saying? No, but you can't talk like that, right? I would be in it. I started moving. Just the adrenaline that flew through me. I flew into a real cognitive rampage. But it only came because I pushed myself. Leo pushed me, a mentor, pushed me into an uncomfortable situation. That moment, that unpredictable moment, that experience blew up a passion. And that passion, I kept feeding more competence. Leo, give me more. And I sought out more mentors, from podcasts that I mentioned in there to guests that were books published. Dr. Bruce Lipton. When he started talking about belief, I say in the book that he describes the power of belief with more potency than I ever could. And he does.
Can you just fill in a little bit more for your audience who Dr. Bruce Lipton is?
He links biology to belief. That's the best way to put it. And just pick up his book. That's the best way to do it, right? Okay. Yeah, I say that in the book too. So, but guys like him started entering, right? The moment I kind of went, wait, I don't have to just know everything. I can relay things that I learn in my language and allow them to process it their way, right? Whatever that language is, not necessarily learning language, but just in my fashion. And Leo helped me cultivate that. He didn't say, you have to sit behind the desk. You need to pass these worksheets out, right? But then I had wonderful Deirdre in the room going, do that note right. Cross your T's, dot your I's. And Leo was like Blossom, right? And so that mentor, that moment, and I talk about in the book, that's what's important, is creating uncomfortable moments purposefully on your own. And by doing so, passions you didn't know can go boom. And when they do, at the same time, by staying humble and knowing that you only relay what you know because you first said, I know what I don't know. Mm-hmm. And through that, listen to me. Enthusiasm is an understatement for when it comes to how I feel about the process of this and the process of how quickly people can change. And mentors, they've fed that in my entire life.
Two of the other figures that you talk about having a really monumental impact on your work include Albert Ellis, who's widely felt to be one of the most influential psychologists in the discipline since its inception. The much more recent addition to our thought universe, Jason Silva. So can you talk a little bit about the impact of these two people who, while there certainly is a confluence in some of the work that they do, in a manner they sit on really different sides of the canon, right? We have a gentleman who has just founded a discipline, so to speak, with cognitive behavioral therapy, giving rise to that movement. And then the other younger figure who is really giving rise to a comfortability of a public conversation about the science of the body, the mind, and the really limitless possibilities of the universe that we live in. So why don't you share with your audience a little bit more about how these two figures have played out in your own thought process and the construction of your work?
Well, that was a good description of both of them. Well done. That was good. Yeah, I love listening to descriptions of Jason Silva because it's a difficult description, you know. Ellis, they both hit my life at two. You could even say that they almost equally impacted my life at the times they hit it, right? Now, my mom, shout out to you, Mom. Love you. She gave me a book called A Guide to Rational Living by Albert Ellis. Back when I wasn't having or reading nothing, in a time. So, but even back then, I could throw away a friend or a person quicker than I throw away a book, even then. And so I always held on to that book. And after some trials, whatever, years later, I happened to start reading that book. And I talk about it in my book, that reading a book can be an experience. And can create a moment that you least expected, especially if you don't want to read the book because it's uncomfortable. And so I just started reading it, and it started to make so much sense from what I ever understood psychology or counseling to be. Because Freud is what you hear about, right? Sexual.
And Lacan is what you dream about. Sorry, I had to throw it in there.
Right. But as general knowledge, right? When you take the psychology course, right? They may mention a few names later. Well, Ellis was actually the founder of REBT. It was Rationally Emotive Behavioral Therapy. And then Beck broke off from him and he began the CBT, CT type movement. So he's really the grandfather, like you said, of all cognitive approaches, really. And in the 70s, I still look at Freud as being the fucking man. Excuse my language, but he's a fucking man. It's my show. What am I worried about? It's her show. So, no, but Freud was gutsy because you go back to a time to where what was wrong with you was demons and fluids and stuff. And then he goes, no, it's because you want to have sex with your mom. Well, that's hard to say. He changed some attitudes, regardless of how wild it was, right? He only got put on the burner when he put his dream book out, and then everyone shunned him in the field. And his daughter's done well. But anyway, when he comes around in the 70s, when Ellis hits the scene, he was a badass. He used curse words, but he did it for a principle and a reason to help push his idea. He was the one that brought the ABCs to us. You have an action. That action is a belief, right? That belief creates a consequence, right? If we change the belief, we change the consequence. That's his ABCs. That's cognitive therapy, or rationally motive therapy. And anyway, so as he kind of puts all this together, he's talking about how dialogue creates the feelings, et cetera. We can control it. And I used to do a good impression of him when he'd be on stage, and he would say, I'm referring to everybody as being rational, but let me be honest, I am rational, so let's talk about you. And so you are the irrational one, so we'll focus on that, shall we? You know, and he would go into this. And what I thought was so gangster about him at the time was he would sit on stage at the school he was at, or any school, and greatest minds in front of him. He would talk for a while, and then he would bring someone up and go, let me show you how this is done. And he would do it. And that to me was Freudian in nature. That to me was a Freudian approach. It was that had that same badass approach, if you will, to say, you know, bump the system. You know, this is how it is. It's not about your feelings or your childhood. It's the now, you know, and the dialogue we use. And that's whether you believe that or not, the approach to say something like that at the moment in the 70s when it was very feel good, very positive psychology. It was very nice. We were going deep into the psyche, right? We were becoming in tune with psychiatry even at the time, right? And he goes, no, change your thought, change your feeling, right? So Ellis, that book was so direct is what I liked. I tried to pick up psychology books in the past, and a lot of them were so theoretically based that I couldn't follow at my training level or my entire idea. I just couldn't follow at the time. So his, that book, A Guide to Rational Living, I suggest everyone read that as almost an intro into psychology, or at least cognitive psychology, because it's such a laid out practical, this makes this, makes this. So that book influenced me huge. It was a seed I think my mom planted. Maybe she knew that back when I was 22 and toting pistols everywhere I went. And that day, 6 years later, you know, I read that book, and it was like, whoa, so you're telling me that I control how I feel the whole time?
Right.
It's not them. It's not what I've been through. It's not what Freud said, that, you know, my past environment determines my future, where I come. Wait a minute. Right? But it was kind of the first time where I had to go, damn, this shit's on me too, all this. It was that self-check. Well, Jason Silva came after the walkabout while I was in the trenches in rehabs. He started a...
This is when you are doing clinical work as a counselor in rehabilitation centers? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Correct. And I was kind of in the midst of the awe, because when you first enter that field, you enter that field going, we're going to help the world. Here we go. And then you get in it and you go, half these people don't give a shit, the practitioners, or they've been so jaded because they're working such a terrible system. And people they just get jaded. It happens. It happened to me because I came in so, let's go to war and fix everybody. And not everybody wants to get fixed.
Yeah.
And then you learn and you go, wow, so I came in really hard and I came out really fast. But when I was in it, in those trenches, Jason had this TV series, number one in the world, Brain Games. Brilliant. My daughter loves it. She watches the Brain Game show. Now we have to do it on Netflix, et cetera. But anyway, so I'm like, man, who's this guy? You know, Jason. And then the Shots of Awe series comes out on YouTube. And whoa. When I watch this guy fly into a cognitive rampage and his philosophical approach to life and going on his thing, and I heard that, man, this guy's got to write this stuff. And I heard that it's kind of a flow state that he puts himself in. He freestyles these moments. And I went, what? I do that. Not that good. But when you catch me in a group and I start working and I'm doing it, because at the end of a group, I'd have this huge wall whiteboard. Be blank when we start. Uh-huh. By the end, I'm writing in little corners. And when I'm standing back and looking at him, I can't read any of that. Right? Because I'm working. And so I appreciated the idea that when his flow state would work, his body would work, he would move. And I'm like, yes, people tap into that. I tapped into that. He made it okay for me to tap into that as much as Leo did. Almost to say, go full throttle. Flow states. I've been a freestyle poet since I was 15, 16. And I had to work at it. I wasn't good at all. I had to work at it. And I got really good at it. And my own, I think I got old though. I don't think I can do it anymore. As good. But anyway, when I was, I could get good. And so as he would flow state in his philosophical approach, I could relate. Because when I would get into it, it would come out that way. And then Leo read the book, actually, and he told me, you know, Adam, the book is almost in verse. And I said, what? He goes, yeah, as you read it sometimes, it has this flow to it in this verse. And I said, it's probably because I wrote the entire book of music in my ear the entire time, just instrumental. So, yeah, those two people, The Cognitive Rampage was influenced huge by Jason Silva. Because watching him do that, when I started this show, I had a laptop that I would open up with a laptop camera and no microphones and a tiny little private office that Leo and I had partnered up with. We'd started doing what we called team therapy. It was worked pretty well. So we have two approaches with one person. And so he was on my show like 10, 20 times, you know, and it would be me and him taking our mentor talks on the air. And I thought, all right, now I'm going to do a little Jason. Let me just freestyle what I really believe about psychology, helping people. And that would happen. Then it flowed a little bit, you know. Then at the time, Joe Rogan was also in my ear heavy as a podcast, you know. So does that answer your question or where do we go? Did I?
It does. And so, you know, it links directly into one of the strategies that you advocate for users, if you will, of the book, because the book is really about being used, being actioned, not just a passive reading experience, right? And so you're inviting your users of this life philosophy practice to seize their own mentors, and you have a pretty strong advocacy position for identifying mentors not only as people that you have access to in your actual everyday landscape. And, you know, I know for myself that resonated really powerfully. And I appreciated that you gave people that input and that suggestion. And the way that you're, you know, you're framing the work of Albert Ellis, of Bruce Lipton, yes, mm-hmm. and Jason Silva, among, you know, many others, you really, your book is sort of a parade of some of the giant thinkers in the field of cognitive behavioral therapy, among many, many other fields from the brain to the body to nutrition and so on. But what you seem to be laying out for people is not to be limiting themselves to what is possible because it's in their immediate actual lived environment and experience, but to be opening themselves up to what can be possible for them just by engaging the cognitive landscapes of others elsewhere in our rather extraordinary universe. Yeah. So I want to move into one of my favorite turns of phrase in the book, and this is where you refer to the mind, the body, and belief as miracle workers, mm-hmm. Which I just think is just a gorgeous way of framing these very everyday terms that so many of us have come to take for granted as already being defined. And you write in the book that your mind, your body, and your beliefs have the power of miracle workers in your life. Can you tell us more about that framing?
Yeah, definitely. First, I'll get clear that all of you that understand, as I do, that the brain is the body because it is in the body, and those two are the same, that we make a clear distinction based on what we think and what processes and generally what we feel. So our feelings, I say, tend to come toward the body, where you get the cold senses, the hot senses, the passionate senses, right? You get those feelings that we speak to that, I don't know, I got to get out of here. Somebody's watching me. I don't know. You know, something, your body moves, right? Your body responds to these things. So your brain is creating the thoughts at the same time. So I wanted to state the mind-body ideal because it spoke about a lot. And it can be very vague. And like I said, mean the same thing. So for me, when I linked the last word to the belief, because what you believe kind of determines what the first two do. So if I believe that my body doesn't work in tune with my mind, if I believe that my mind has no effect on my body, well, you can't have two without the third. So what you believe determines the work. If you believe your body has no effect on your mind or your life or anything, or your thoughts or functioning, well, all right, then it won't work in unison, you know? So building the framework around there, I thought, was a common place that many could understand as a place to start before we dissect it. Because the idea of belief can get really hazy and get really fuzzy. So I try to sum up giant theoretical notions with simple terminology to sum up, like saying, let's accept the principle, for instance, that beliefs create thoughts, that thoughts create feelings. Feelings can predict behavior. So if we can adapt to that principle for now and not argue the fact that, yes, we can have biological influences to thoughts that are environment influences, which I also talk in the book that the beliefs we have come from what we experience. So you got to give it up to the environmental behavioral influence, right? So it's about trying to adapt to not the argument of proving certain theoretical ideas are real or not, because those arguments exist. And it says the cognitive rampage for various reasons, but cognitive because that's the basis of the approach. But it's a rampage because God forbid that an approach look at another approach and go, hey, what you say works too. And God forbid the behavioralists look at the cognitive people and go, hey, we could do this together. And they start to Beck, the cognitive behavioral therapist. But in our field, as you know, there's clear distinctions between, well, what do you practice? What type of scientist are you? What type of practitioner are you? What type of therapist, psychologist? I'm a psychoanalyst. I'm a solution focused, but right. It gets so, but we forget that we're all here to help people. So yeah, cognitive is rampaging against that idea of some formal structure that there is only one way to change and to transcend and to authentically you. And so this is just a path of a framework built that has roads to many paths that you lay out from what you believe. And so we dissect what belief means. And then you reveal your definition of that, right? So we pull from all of those concepts, but it really matters what you, the reader, believes or what the person involved in this experience believes. Because you said it's not just a read, it's interactive. There's inventories, there's life philosophies that you'll reveal, which I think is pretty neat. You know, at the end, you have a 15, 16 sentence life philosophy that your words that you wrote that you read out and go, man, I like that. I could live by that. I'm like, it's your words, of course. So it's not my philosophy, right? It's that's why I said it's a dose of authentic revelation. It's getting into and dissecting the belief, because what we believe truly is why people state that's just who I am, right?
So you're asking the users in this book, you're asking the readers to construct their own life philosophy, right? And the way that you are asking folks to go about this is to conduct what you call a rational self-analysis, going through what you say are three core beliefs, three core areas of belief, right? The world, others, and self. What do you believe about the world? What do you believe about others? What do you believe about yourself? And then you invite people to analyze in a very iterative, intensive manner each of these areas. Can you give us a descriptive example, an illustration of this rational self-analysis for one of the core beliefs area? You know, what does that actually look like for someone in play when they're applying the rational self-analysis to a core belief area?
To to sum it up in an over, like, you know, like I like to do, dissect it, give you the over top and work down, I would say that there's, many people don't understand that there's a difference between self-criticism and self-analysis. This world has taught us to be critics. Everything we do is thumbs down, don't like, do like, my taste, my brand. And so we also self-criticize. And so where people, I think, not even by fault of their own almost, start to blur those lines like I think we do texting and driving these days.
Don't any of the listeners do that. No texting and driving.
Oh, we look for drive down the road and just start looking over, and you'll see them. They're swerving in front of you. My point is we blur those lines. So what we're taught to do is look in the mirror and criticize the outfit, criticize the reflection. Right? We're taught that, right? We're shown commercials. You could argue that marketing was the death of the human psyche. As once that's created, it's telling you what you're supposed to be and giving you images. It's feeding you. So
the personal brand.
Sure. And so then we start to criticize. So what I'm saying is we criticize our relationships, right? We criticize ourselves. We become masters at self-criticism is what I say in the book. We become masters at it. And when I'm going through something in life, let me be in a life transition. Oh, man, I'm the king of criticism, especially self. But what I'm going to reflect is you even approach me at once. I'm going to be like, why are you? You know, why are you coming, right? Why are you coming at me? Right? We get touchy. So we're almost bred and then self-inflicted later to live because your parents criticize you. They hold the report card up. You're better than this, right? I mean, you're compared in contrast from your shoes when you start early to your book bags and your grades to your performance to your looks, right? So now life hits you. Well, whew, I become the master of self-criticism. I can find everything. I can point out every little thing in the environment that I can fixate on that's negative. So what RSA helps you to do is to learn, because what you do is you learn how to think. You learn how to think the way you do. So first you got to learn how to question it. Before you even get to RSA, there's things you have to do. There's principles you have to learn to apply, okay? So otherwise, RSA just sounds like something that's like wordplay.
This is the rational self-analysis.
Right. This is the first tool of change, essentially. You mentioned the life philosophy. That's the second tool of change. So you apply RSA to reveal your philosophy. So, but RSA, though, that step, it begins of questioning yourself and asking yourself why. We tend to go, well, what do I believe about the world? Ask somebody that randomly. Ask yourself that is what I encourage you to do. What do I believe about the world? And I say your first response, work from there. Don't think about it long. Oh, man, the world's fucked up. Oh, man, the world's a great place, right? We start there. Then it goes, now let's look at that sentence and ask, well, why do you believe that? Well, I believe that because, all right, well, why do you believe that? So if we're willing to question everyone around us, the ones we love, the environments, our political candidates, criticize the Netflix series. We can do this on Facebook, right? We can be so critical. But for a moment, if we could turn that to analysis and then ask ourselves those questions. The idea is if you can cultivate what you really believe, that concrete belief. You spoke about the three belief principles, the three core beliefs too, which is yourself, others, and the world. But it moves to that idea of your concrete core beliefs. Are they negative? Are they positive? And then what it does is it walks you through a very easy 1, 2, 3, 4 of how to reveal what you really believe and then reframe that to be rational, not irrational, to make sense, not be like, oh, the world is full of lovely people. This is irrational. So it's not going to lead you to write something that's going to sound good on a stage one day when I'm saying it. Right? No, you're going to reconstruct it to be rational first. Once it's rational, end that sentence to be optimistic. Because I say, look, you can live in the idea of a guaranteed negative or skeptic outcome, or you can live in the idea or the hope of your optimistic reality.
Right.
So RSA teaches you how to be rational, be logical, and also frame that to live in the optimistic hope of your reality, of your own beliefs, your own construction, not what I believe.
So this book in so many ways seems to represent the culmination of an exceptional journey. And I want to take you back right now to 9, 10 years ago.
Oh, boy.
You're at the the height of a very different career at that point in your life. You're at the top of the game in the nightclub industry. It's a very different lifestyle than the cognitive rampage lifestyle, a lifestyle of well-being and holistic, transformational thinking. By contrast, you know, a little over a decade ago, you're up until 4, 5, 7 in the morning.
3 days.
3 days in a row on the club scene.
So,
there are a lot of drugs involved in your life at that point in time, and also a lot of external material success. And yet, after a night of epiphany, as you describe it, you determined to literally walk away from your entire life at that moment and go on what we call a walkabout. So what was that moment in time for you leading into the night of epiphany?
That's a, well, to say top of the night club game would be kind. I would say somewhere.
So this is practicing one of your basic premises in the book about humility, I think, is what you're doing right now.
Well, no, it's true, because I was somewhere at the bottom of that, the way I saw it. There were so many in the game, as we used to refer it. There were two games, and I got in the habit of referring to things that I did as the game. But the nightclub business can be a game, and it's a nasty game. It can be ugly. It's as bad as the dope game sometimes. It was nasty. And to be at the top of it is, I don't know, I probably wouldn't be here anymore. But there's, at the time, there was the nightclub scene, if you will, that ultra lounge type scene was hitting big. It was the creation of the white couches and the bottle services beyond the Studio 52 versions of it, right? It became dress code enforced. It became celebrities at the table, right? If you lived in Orlando, it was that giant emergence of Roxy, the infamous Roxy nightclub. And so at the time, a lot of people were getting into that business, you know, and I was even a DJ at one point to start. And I just kind of worked my way up through it, trying a bunch of different things in the environment. But So the nightclubs were post-dope game, and they intertwined, you know, obviously. And at this time, when you refer to the walkabout, this was, I tried to remove myself from the game once before, and it was, I couldn't do it. You know, it was 7, 8 years in the game. This is where everything had built to, you know, it's what you're involved in. It becomes who you are. You know, that was the statement. I'm Adam. I'm the nightclub guy. You can get you anything you want. That was it. And I don't know, nothing really happened. You know, I've talked about that night a few times, and people are like, something had to happen that night. What happened? I'm like, honestly, nothing. I was happy that it was a early night from the club. I was home by 3 o'clock. I'm like, this is nice. Couldn't wait to be home by myself. And at the time, it was roll a blunt, enjoy quiet, you know, no loud music and shit. So that's, nothing happened. But the first thing I do remember happening was first asking, what do you do for a living? And I never really asked myself that, because I'd always sold what I do for a living, because that's what doing that for a living is. So you don't question what you're doing, you know? So I'm like, what do I do? All right. And then something was like, what would happen if we turn the music off and turn the lights on? What's everybody doing, Adam? And I was like, whoa, that's kind of odd, you know? Anyway, so the thoughts go there. And then I started questioning it. Is this how you're going to find somebody? Is this how you're going to grow? Is this it? The question we all ask sometimes, right? The fatal, is velvet ropes the purpose? Is this it, right? And from there proceeded a 16-hour conversation with myself, I guess, in the living room, a spiritual experience, some would refer to it as. I could tell you that's probably what I would refer to it as right now. At the time, was not religious at all. Couldn't be. Had to remove myself to cope with some things, but it was just started with questioning myself. And I say in the book too, for some reason, I played that song Stained Epiphany over and over and over for 16 hours. And in the book, I'm like, I know it sounds crazy, but I even referenced that you got to be willing to get a little crazy to get a little sane sometimes. And maybe I was talking to myself for 16 hours. I don't know. We all do that, I think, from time to time. But this was focused. I tried meditating. I tried a lot of different things. I cried. I yelled. A couple pillows didn't make it. Because it was this idea of, like, shed it all.
So the purge.
Yeah. It was just shed it all as fast as you can. And I was like, are you fucking kidding me? What? No. This defines me. And then when I started saying that, I started going, but then my problem with authority kicked in. When I went, this defines me. No, shit. I guess I am a sheeple to something, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah, within 48 hours, man, I was gone.
So you take this, you could call it brave, courageous, crazy step out of the life that you know into just walking forward in the most literal fashion, right, imaginable. And what brought you back? Because I think many people in the audience can understand what drives us out of the pressures and the uncomfortabilities, the dissatisfactions that we might have with the life that we're living. You know, it can be a fantasy for some people, this idea that I'll just become a nomad, yeah, travel forward.
They write books on it.
I will find enthusiasm, you know, which literally means a God within yourself. And I will just walk through life.
Yeah, that's a primal idea. I love that notion.
And so once you engage this primal experience of a walking forward as a way of being, what is it that called you to come back, to participate, to lead, to guide, to help others?
Shit, I do all that?
About having their own cognitive rampage, their own epiphany in life.
That's kind that you say I do all that. I think I just talk on a microphone and write passionately about trying to help people. What brought me back? That's a good question for me. What brought me back? It's like I had to come back to the den. I had to test it one more time with what I'd learned to make sure it was real, if that makes sense. So I put myself right back where I was, right from where I left and journeyed from. And I mean, the very house and well, it wasn't the same. I bought an 89 Tahoe when I got back from my uncle that made for a good bed once in a while. And, I started coaching at the YMCA that was right next to our place. And, it's like I had the experience something that a place that I had a belief of. I had left Orlando a lot. The nightclub business takes you a lot of places. So yeah, we did things in Orlando, but we did things in a lot of other places, and the other business takes you even further. So to be back, you know, in a place that I had ran from, and my first thought, and then I love that quote from the movie Into the Wild about the true story where he goes, they thought I was running. That's only because they have a social reference and a construct to what they're doing as he's seeking. And so more was seeking, you know, instead of the run. But at the time it felt like, you know what, I got to test myself, you know. So put myself right back there, right with the same place. But I said, this time I'm going to just do what I know to help. So maybe facing... I'd given a place too much power. And I think we all tend to do that sometimes. Whether it's an old home, an old neighborhood, an old job, or an old person. We give it so much power. We hold that. We construct that perception. And so for me, Orlando was a bad place. It's a place I did bad things.
Right.
Jacksonville, I did even worse things. And that's why it's the first stop on the tour. It's a random smaller city like Jacksonville in the middle of a tour, but there's a reason. And so when you face past experiences in those places and you can force thoughts and create different behaviors and shape new perceptions of them. And you realize that it's not where you live. It's not the job. It's not the place. It's not the past. It's how I perceive it. And we perceive it based on what we've experienced in it. So I had to make a new experience in a place that I had a bad perception of. That's probably the answer to what brought me back.
Well, this dovetails, really perfectly into the next exceptional shift that you make in your life. You have this moment, you go on the walkabout as a result of a night of epiphany. You spend this time seeking, finding, you come back, you make the decision to come back from the journey. And then you go about getting yourself, as we like to say, degreed up, right?
Earn my stripes.
That's right. So you get your degrees.
Yeah.
And
I played the system, yeah. I
had to jump into practice. You're doing the work. You're in the field. What makes that next transition out of doing the work in rehabilitation centers as a counselor, as a therapist? What pulled you out of being part of the therapeutic system in a more traditional manner and into doing the work that you do today?
To back up on the walkabout, too, to be clear, I don't want to make it sound like I took some sort of nightclub riches and went and vagabonded across the world and found myself, because many people refer to a walkabout as doing so. And when I got back, I learned it's not about finding yourself. I even say in the book where it's even in the foreword, I think, on Amazon, where I say, stop saying you have to find yourself. But first I say, find the nearest mirror, go to it, look in it. There. Now that you found yourself, it's time to use yourself again. And so that statement of finding myself is not what that walkabout was about. It was about shedding myself, really. And I didn't just stay in little hostels and make this. There was no storybook to this shit. The first thing I did when I left was my brother had an offset company somewhere that was digging holes for Key West military Air Force Base in the Keys, but it was August. I'm like, find me a way.
Wow.
Find me a way on there. And I gave everything I had away. So I didn't take a pocket check with me. I didn't take bank with me. No. I mean, even my suits. Gave them all my suits away, too. Shout out to you, PJ. I just handed over a nightclub VIP thing that I'd built up and just went, I'm out. And he just left. And here's the suits if they fit you. And so I went and started digging holes. And that's what I did in the August limestone runways was fill holes and dig holes for poles. Slept on a linoleum floor with four other construction labor workers. And, you know, but I read, I worked out, I fished, I swam, I ran. I mean, that's all I did. I'm like, get me away from cocaine talk for hours about some business you got, you know, get me out of it. So that was the walkabout, you know, it was rough in it, you know, maybe that's better. You know, but this was no Kerouac sleeping under the stars, riding the rails, dreaming about how beautiful it was. You know, this was a shedding of a belief system. You know, this was painful. And so coming back from that, the shift out of the academic, I'm skipping the whole got the degree. When I mentioned there, I played the system, which means, look, the system's still in play. So if you play the system, if you buy the house, make the investment, work the long job, for the most part, averages still play to your favor. That your credit will look good, you'll be able to invest, and you'll take a vacation or two, maybe three if you're lucky, a year. And maybe you won't die before then, and your health insurance will cover that sickness that's going to get you. You know, and you can, and that's cool. I'm not hitting on any of that. So went left field on me. So that transition out of it. So my point is I went into the system. I said, okay, I'll go to school. I'll get the degrees because that's how you say I have to help people. Because I came back going, I want to help people. And I'm personal training. Who fucking doesn't? You know, but it fed me. You know, I was coaching the kids. I'm like, this works. I got to speak in front of a middle school. That was my first speaking experience ever. I prepared for 2 weeks for a 15-minute after-school talk to the athlete leaders of my old middle school. There was like 15 of them. 2 weeks I prepped for that.
That's adorable. That's great.
Yeah. And ended up winging the whole thing and didn't do anything that I prepped for. And anyway, that was the first time I talked. I'm getting left field. So this whole idea of going, so this is how the system tells me I have to help people. And it'll be my first job once I'm out. Then, you know, I may have had a random job in between lives.
This is your first professional.
Yeah. When I got out of school, I realized I never clocked in. Like an official clock-in thing. They're teaching me. I'm like, what? I punch a number and do what? I'm like, why do you do this every day? Twice? Why? You know, and I felt so programmed. All right, I'm leaving now, right? There's some movie reference there, I know. But that's a reference to Steve. I guess you could probably say I've, a lot of my life bucked the system and my problem with authority. And like I say in the book, though, that philosophy has a double-edged sword to it. So it comes with its pros and cons. But to move outside of it, once I learned how I'm supposed to help people and then how we are helping people, then how we could help people, I mean, competence, experience. Once all that happened, I went, what the fuck? I can't do this. I'm like, I can't help someone within your conservative bounds of saying that I can't give a hint. I have to, I see they tell you, don't give advice. So any of you mental health counselors out there, don't think you're going to good at giving advice, because the first ethical class and thing they teach you in class is don't give advice, because you create therapeutic dependence, therapist dependence, and they'll have to come back to you for every answer. All right. But if the therapist is good enough, no, you work it. But so for me, it was like, wait, but they're coming for advice, but we have to dance around them when we might have a direction we can help, but we can't say that. Why don't you just say what it really is? You want a client for 6 months. Let's just say what it really is. You see? So when I started seeing this, and I said, who gets better once a week for 45 minutes? And who's got $150 a week to spend for that kind of help? Yeah, you can have Medicare, Medicaid, and you can go to a tiny little jailhouse help place. There's some tough workers in those trenches, busting their asses to help people. You get lucky, you find one of those that's not jaded yet. But that's where help was. Help was if you got insurance. I said, man, I know what kind of help I needed. I know how stubborn my fucking ass was. The things I was dealing with. You know, ghetto's in the mind frame. So what other people were dealing with, their ghetto was as bad as mine. I thought, this is what we offer. They told me to teach the steps, even though the steps didn't work for me.
And this is, you are referring to the 12 steps.
I am. Not, I don't want to get too far knocking it, because it helps a lot of people. That's all I'm not. But I'm just telling you
it
the
does,
mind frame.
Yes.
I'm setting you in the moment. Mm-hmm. This is my mind frame at the time.
Right.
I went through the steps. It just didn't work for me. Okay. And that's okay. I'm seeing it not work for many, many others. Sure, they may not be trying. We get into the semantics of it. But I don't have a theory that I can say works, but only if you do it right. My point was, there was more we could offer. Keep the steps. It has beautifully worked for millions of people. Please keep it. But that's it. And this was the weird part. We didn't have one class on the 12 steps in my entire counsel training. Not one. I have a master's of mental health counseling, and I didn't take a class, not a segment, not a semester on the 12 steps.
Despite being expected to draw on it for your
period
therapeutic
practice. 85% of the approach, 20%, 15% CBT was starting to get worked in, cognitive behavioral therapy. But it wasn't only if the directors were forcing it. And Leo was doing very good at that. Leo was pushing in the CBT, and he saw me as somebody that would say, let's get this in there. And I would teach it. I would teach CBT, but not call it CBT. You know what I mean? And I could see it working. And so the transition came, really. I mean, the truth, do you want the whole truth or not about the truth, so help us cave?
Absolutely. That's what we come here for, is a dose of authentic revelation.
Okay. Sorry, manager, agent people, if this hurts the book, but it's the truth. I was pressured with a daughter and family to do what you're supposed to do, to get the job, to pay the bills, right? This is where your problem, coming out of school. I owned a detail company for a while. I was doing coaching. I was doing some things because I lived down in Marco Island at the time, really involved in the community there. And but now school was finished. I got through the trenches, right? I'd been working.
Sure.
A couple years at the Willow and, oh, shit, we got to edit that out. Anyway, shout out to the people that are grinding there, putting their heart in. There's some people that are working in there that are really trying. So I had a two-week vacation planned. I had stepped away from clinical, focused heavy on business, my entrepreneur stuff like I do. Had a little money coming in doing this and that, but it was the time. I got to get the license, do the 2 years of licensure, get paid $18 an hour, get whipped and work in the same environment that I'd been in for the last 3 years, not being able to help many. And many people being controlled by a system, a process in place. You know, I don't necessarily want to point out it's the facilities all the time or what, you know, this is what we work in. So my daughter had a volleyball camp. I'm a volleyball dad. Shout out to Thus Bearing the Grind. And she had a camp at Pepperdine. We go out there, we drop her off. My wife and I had a vagabonding trip planned. You know,
this is California.
Yeah. Yes. We go out to Cali. And I'd been away from where I'd been working and business maybe a year. And doing the rampage, sort of, you know, just writing the book, sort of. And we go out there and the plan is drop Momo off for a week and let's just drive. We had a concert planned out in the desert for Sublime. We were going down to San Diego. We were going to drive up the coast. We were going everywhere. And we had a pit stop, all my idea, of going to the Joshua Tree with some mushrooms.
One of U2's best albums, by the way, it must be said. So carry on.
And like a champ. She's like, yeah, let's go. You know, I knew my daughter was fine. We were good, you know, and it's a place. And I suggest everyone attempt it maybe once in your life. There's a great place out there, man. The Joshua Tree Motel. Shout out to your Ravi. He knows. Anyway, so I went in. I treat those things not as this good time. This is a moment. This is therapy. This is a revelation and, you know, in a place of love and clarity and nature. And that's what I went for. And I went for that moment and had a session. And for me, I went in asking the question, how do I help? What?
So I think you're kind of skirting around.
Oh, I'm going to get there.
Here. When you say you went in and you had a session,
yes,
what
we
do
ate
you
psilocybin.
Mean by that?
We ate psilocybin in a safe dosage in a safe place. And she's also an ARMP nurse practitioner, so I have medical help around at the same time.
So this is you and your partner are drawing on
my wife,
your wife. Mm-hmm. You know, I've spent a lot of time in California, and they just train you. Everyone is a partner in all circumstances. Everything.
She's that too. She was definitely that night too.
So you and your wife are cultivating this moment, drawing on a really long history of utilizing natural psychedelics in order to provoke a transformational moment in your life.
And it was myself. Yeah? It was me. She was my medical assistant, if you will, and more than that.
So you got like super serious with the backup and you had everything.
Yeah, that's how I said, if anyone does that, you know, please know what you're doing. And all of this, I knew where it had come from. It was all prepared and and safe.
Wade Davis, Dr. Wade Davis, an anthropologist who trained, I believe, at Harvard, refers to the psychedelic experience as something akin to being shot out of a cannon, like through your nose. But you come out on the other side, possibly with some greater revelation. So,
yeah, well, that's why I said this may hurt the book. I'm a crazy person, whatever. I'm just telling you what my perception was in my experience. I get that. Feel free, anyone, to create your own. And I went in kind of going, what do I do? How do I help? how? You know, I'm rampaging, really. Like, how do I help people the way I know that science, research, smart people have developed paths that you can work and build on that help? How do I help my family? How do I do all this when I feel this passion that I know? We got to work outside of these boxes. We got to reach people bigger, harder. We got to kick in the front door. And for me, the book finally was the culmination of learning how to kick in the front door, but also sneak in the back window and be waiting for you. And so the book is that with Leo. And so at the end of this spiritual moment, there's a picture on my Instagram, actually. If people really are watching on Instagram, the entire story is told that I'm telling now via pictures. From the very moment that I took a picture of the desert sky when I was in the midst of one of the most beautiful sights I'd ever seen, and we'd been walking, and it started raining in the desert. It hadn't been raining there for a long time, obviously, and it was beautiful kind of rain, just light, you know, and the sky was dancing, if you know what I mean, because the desert, what it does when it rains, is gorgeous. And you could say whatever you want. An epiphany in my thoughts became as where it said, when you're on the microphone, say it loud. When you're around your friends, watch your shit. Because at the time, I was not a fun person to have at a barbecue. Because I wasn't going to talk to you about sports, the weather. I try. And before I know it, I'm questioning whether you think cursing is okay. Or whether you understand that our political system is rigged. Right? This is where I'd go. You'd like, I just want to eat a hot dog. You know what I mean? And I was that guy. And so,
not the fun guy at the party. You were missing the fun in the recipe.
Yeah. When I used to be
you
the
way.
You
can't make authentic fried chicken without fun, you know.
And I was the way fun guy. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So this is a slight you look at the contrast from when I was the guy. And you know what I mean? And you're like, who the fuck are you? Even some of my friends today are like, we had no idea you were kind of intelligent. And I'm like, I am? All right. But anyway, and I couldn't fathom what that meant because I hadn't done a cognitive rampage in almost 6 months. And I'd never done a Facebook video. I'd only done these Ustream things with, like, I remember the night we got like 20 followers or 20 viewers or listens or something. We were like, woo, all right. You know, it was that shitty, you know, it was terrible. And so I just kind of stopped after I left where I was working. I just didn't feel right. I just kind of put it all down. I had to go into this hibernation maybe. I like that. And now bring me back, man.
Well, it actually moves directly into...
Oh, wait. I got to finish this. Bring me back. Please.
You were talking about your experience, how that brought you to from California.
Yes. And you thank you. And so my point is I hadn't done any microphones, never videos, no YouTube, nothing. And I'm like, microphone? What do you mean when I'm on the microphone? I don't... There's not a microphone in my vicinity. I'm like, I'm no podcast thought. You know, I'd really put this to bed. And anyway, we sort of tried to bring it back in Naples. Steve, that's when we first met. Steve first came down and we did a show called The Conversation. We put a little heartbeat back into it for a little bit. We tried the Social Pulse. We tried a bunch of different variations of a show in Naples. And we just never held on. And I shit you not, 2 days later, I'm on the Joe Rogan Experience podcast. Now, yeah.
Eschatological transformations can count for something.
Now, that's all by chance, fate, whatever you want to call it, you know? Now, if you'd have talked to me through 2 years or whatever, when I started being a listener, heavy listener, I told everyone, I said, I'm going to bring this message to Joe Rogan. Watch, I'm going to be on that podcast. I used to say it because he was bringing a message. He was bringing competence. He was questioning himself, the world, and others. Well, that's a good basis. And I thought, I get with that. He's coming from the same theory, right? So as he was talking to him, like, man, so I thought, what do I say? What am I doing? What am I going to say on the microphone, right? And at the time, there was like this wannabe website, till Steve blessed it, right? There was just nothing, you know?
You mean you had a website at that time that you weren't necessarily pleased with?
And I had a book, too.
that you were in the works with?
Well, I had taken Tim Ferriss's approach to writing a book at the time. He's very influential. He's in the book, too. But I had got it all out between A to Z. And somewhere between that mess, I knew were two books. You know, so I'd gotten that far. Fantastic. So when I talked about the two books on Rogan, you notice I didn't push him. I didn't talk about him. It was like, only when he asked. You know, I was like, yeah, books. But before I went on the show, I was like, I have to get this chemical incarceration message out there. I got to tell people what I've seen. And I did very generally, and some things I kind of look back and regret that I was very general about. But in the moment, A, I was starstruck. Two, I was like, I can't fucking believe this is happening. Three, I walked into a live podcast that I didn't know was live. I sat down and just went to work, and I just started, you know, and do you know, 14 hours after doing that podcast, I was fired from my job in Orlando as a therapist.
Oh, you were actually fired.
I had been hired as a therapist at a place before I left because I had gone into hibernation, and guess what you got to do when you have a daughter and a kid and a student loan? You got to get the job, right? That's what you got to do. So, all right. I went and got two. So I had two jobs, one that I was going to start in 2 weeks when I got back, one I'd already been hired for. Within 24 hours, the other one had let me go. Never returned my phone calls or emails to schedule the signing of everything. So both jobs within 24 hours were off my table, not by my choice, maybe because I said what I said. So when you ask me all the way back to what pulled me out of doing it with a license and this conservative method and why I choose to cognitively rampage, that's probably one of the longest answers I'd tell you, because all that was influential. And in a way, Joe cognitively rampaged. He changed the face of how you interview, what you talk. He went for 3 hours. You know, he would pry into things. He'd be confrontational, almost like a good therapist. He knew how to be confrontational, which is what most therapists can't do very well. I struggle. I still gig in the front door, you know. And so that was game-changing. And I, how the fuck does that happen? That's all I could tell myself is what the... And then I processed it, and I went, well, there was a moment, because I had tried to see him as a at a comedy show, but we were leaving. So the rest of the story, to make it even more weird, is we were up, and I picked up my daughter 2 days later.
So this is, you go into the desert, you see the Joshua tree, you have your transformational thought process, but it's really sort of an abstract, a series of ideas. Then you go back into civilization, as it were, and
we spend one more day out there. Yeah, we spend a day of rest out at the desert as well, not partaking, and just to, you know, calm down from that, soak it in, reflect. You know, they call them trip reports sometimes, right? This was a trip reflection, maybe. And we pick up my daughter. We go up to it's the Redwoods to see those. So we're supposed to spend 2 days up there. We spend a whole day up there, and I can tell my daughter's really itching to see Melrose. Our plane left Wednesday. Plane leaves at Wednesday, 10 a.m. the 22nd. It is the 21st. We're supposed to stay at the forest, drive back in the morning, and fly home. I'm like, you know what? You know, let's leave tonight. Forget the hotel. Let's just go. Let's get out of here and let's go see Melrose. I know that's what you want to see. So we do. We stay at the hotel. We Uber up to the road. She goes, Dad, look. I'm like, what? She goes, Rogan's at the Improv tonight. I went, what? He's supposed to do a show on Wednesday, and I just wasn't going to be able to see him this time. It was cool. She's like, I'm like, he's here. Great. So I'm like, all right, now I got to sneak my daughter into the bar. That was the first thought. My first thought went, all right, how do I get my 16-year-old into this bar? I mean, and we do. I said, put your Pepperdine sweater on right now.
So that you don't have to leave her alone at the hotel room.
No, we're all on Melrose. So I'm like, oh, yeah, and so the show starts
sort of
in like an hour.
The moment, yeah.
So I said, put your Pepperdine sweater on. So she does, and she's like 5'10". You know, so we walk over, we play it off. Hey, I did nightclubs for a living. If I can't get my own daughter into the bar, I don't know what I'm doing. Well, there's a giant line, and what I thought was funny is we moved for parking, and my wife goes, we're going to be in a line when we get back. And I'm like, no, you won't, baby. Just trust me. We park, huge line. She's like, I told you. And I go, no, no, no. Trust me. So with a 16-year-old, my wife and me walk around the corner, walk right by all the lines, and walk right through the door with a little magic. And my daughter's like, how'd you do that? I'm like, I told you, it's what I used to do. And we talked to people. We didn't sneak in, right? We said hello and just came right in. And got her sat down, whatever. And a couple comments come on, Joe goes on, he goes off. And I'm like, I gotta pee. And if you're ever gonna shake this dude's hand and tell him, you know, hey, my plan wasn't even to say thank you. Like, I think a lot of people were like, thank you. It was kind of like to be like, dude, we got to say some shit, or you, please, you dive down this rabbit hole and it will change lives. You know what I mean? It could change wreck systems and save lives, you know? So I like, all right, just go. And I did a short video the next day after what it felt like, because I was like, dude, you're a fucking stupid idiot. Because I'm going to go approach a guy or just a dude, you know what I mean? And I'm acting like I was quite uncomfortable. And I said, well, I think that's where the change is. So I walked right into it, and it was so fucking uncomfortable because he had buried himself in the corner, entourage of friends kind of around him. So I turned the corner. I'm like, oh shit. He sees me, he says hi, he's very kind. He says hello. And I'm like, hell, he can't hear me. And I'm like, this is just fucking awkward. And I go, forget it. And I go to walk off. He goes, no, man, for real. Come here, what's up? And I don't know what I said. I don't. But I think I just went, hi, I'm Adam. There's a whole bunch of money grab bullshit going on, and they're fucking taking their drug. They're killing people. I think I just dove out the chemical incarceration concept. And he was like, this week, can you do a podcast tomorrow? My plane left at 10 a.m. He goes, can you do a podcast at 2 p.m. tomorrow? And I was like, yeah, hell yeah. Hell yeah, I can. Then the rush to get my girls home and me stay back. And so that opportunity that he took, that chance, I did that video. Well, I was afraid. I was afraid to say hello to somebody. You think I'm stupid? Well, maybe that's just chance knocking at your door is what I referenced in the video. So take that chance is kind of what I did. And I didn't know what I was going to do. When I got back from California, I'm like, I know what I love to do. I love to podcast. And I met Steve. And Steve has been the cornerstone to all this. And that's what we did. And we have lived that cognitive rampage together and as a tribe and some close people around me. So, yeah, that's the long answer to all of that. Holy shit.
He's been on a rampage, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, you're tapping into me. Usually I'm the one asking all the questions.
Well, circling back through to keep up with this Cognitive Rampage podcast thread, obviously, you know, part of your vision for this thread has been bringing the idea of chemical incarceration front and center.
Yeah.
But also, you know, what comes out of your book and a number of the conversations that you've had with guests is emotional incarceration, that people are addicted to certain emotional paradigms.
Yeah. I like that. You see me shaking my head. If I'm ever looking away, I'm like, I like that.
Yeah. And so tell us a little bit about how you frame the idea of addiction when we get beyond the border of a substance, because there's a whole story about addiction that's related to industry. And we can talk, you know, pretty in depth about the industrial side of addiction. And so this is, you know, everything from your heroin market to your opiates, you know, and onward and through. And that's a pretty comfortable spot for a lot of people to talk about addiction, because if you're not an active user, you get to be exempt from the conversation. You know, I'm not a drug user. I'm not a drink user and so forth. When we remove the borders on addiction and we take away this boundary of it having to do with a substance, and we start thinking about behaviors, people who are addicted to angry reactions, that it's carved into their neural network. When you do A, I will lose my shit. People who are addicted to repeating the same devastating stories of pain in their lives over and over again. Talk to us about addiction beyond the boundaries of substance and into the boundaries of experience, the experiential side of addiction.
Yeah. Well, it would possibly be somewhere to safe to say that we all have our own drug, whether that's work, working out. I think in a way we all have an addiction to something. Some call it replacement therapy. I don't know. Whatever it takes to get you better. But addiction, that's one of the regrets from the show, but it's such a, we're so focused on the fucking symptoms. That's probably why I get in trouble. That's why. It's like the whole mental health field and psychology and pharmacology. We're so focused on symptoms, symptomatic reactions. Or we react. There's no preventative work. So addiction is all phases. It's environmental. It's cognitive. It's biological. It's a mix. And we're so busy debating on which one is more. And I think we forget to fucking help people. And how far we could get if the behavioralists stopped defining themselves with those borders constructed by their study. And said, hey, cognitive study people, what do you do? You know, I mean, what do you biological people know? You know, that's why I talk about Dr. Rhonda Patrick so much. She's probably the biggest mentor from a biological scientific influence in my life than any of the mentors mentioned in that book, possibly. She got me interested in those and connecting the gut to the brain, to the mood. Once you start real, so the book may say cognitive rampage, but like I said, it's all fields. It's all facets. It has to be, we got to work together in that. So when we talk about addiction, treating addiction almost in a sense, if you treat the drugs, in my opinion, you're treating a symptom. You know, if you have the flu and it comes with a sore throat and I give you something that stops the sore throat, you still have the fucking flu. And the way we're structured to help people is to treat the symptoms. We don't help. We don't solve anything. It's about treatment and not necessarily even cures, but there's ways to untie those things, you know. So addiction becomes so chopped up and so debated about whether it's a disease or not. Whether it's brain related, whether it's genetic, whether it's, I think Rat Park experiment tells us a lot.
And for people who are not familiar with the Rat Park experiment, can you describe that a little bit more?
I'll do it short because it's described by a lot of people. And Dr. Carl Hart, who's a mentor I reference a lot, who's been a huge mentor in the how I practiced when I was treating people with addiction. He's been a huge focus into how I did that. I don't necessarily do that anymore, but when I did that, referencing first the definition of drugs, of its being so vague, right? But what was that? We're talking about the symptoms. Dr. Carl Hart threw me off.
The rat.
Oh, the rat park. Yeah. So what he talked about is the rat park experiment. What most people understood or were saw the commercials of or the research on was cocaine and the rat. And so the rat would be in a cage. They had water and cocaine to choose from, et cetera. He kept choosing cocaine until death and actually died of dehydration, not overdose of cocaine, which is one of the misconceptions of that test that they show. But dies of the dehydration. And so what do we say? Cocaine's addictive and it'll kill you. And then that's what you get. So Dr. Carl Hart is one of the ones that talks about, let's look, what we understand as addiction for one in drugs is what we know in intervention. I'll correlate the two outside of addiction and drugs, but is this small 10 to 15% that you watch on TV shows like Intervention. It's the 85% that you call functional addicts or whatnot, but they use substances that are what we would call harmful drugs even, but they use them to where they're as harmful as, I don't know, eating corn every day or high fructose corn syrup, right? I mean, these things are all comparative. And Dr. Carl Hart is the leader who trains the trainers that treat people with these. So he's the one that started that conversation about, let's look at what we're talking about here. So drugs is like saying, I like sports, right? That's a lot. It's very vague. And so first you got to know what you're talking about. I think on a direct level, Yes, it's biological. It's all of these. Does it matter if we define it as a disease or not? Does that matter? Or does it matter if we help the person that's being affected by the disease? Which one is most important? So if we can combine everything together, work together, pull those things, like what I did here in the book was pull from all the theories. I pull from behavioral for everything. And this book is not written for the addict. It's not written, and I hate that word, the addict, because I wrote that book for those being affected by addiction, right? Because you're not an addict. You're not. You introduce yourself as, hi, I am an addict. No, I am Adam and I'm being affected by, you know, we don't say I am headache, you know, so the dialogue, that separation, but that's just where it starts. It starts with the beliefs, the dialogue, but then you hear it all the time, change people, places, things, right? But if you don't change the beliefs, then it doesn't last long.
And so this is a common AA, Alcoholics Anonymous slogan, change people, change your places, change your things in order to get sober and stay sober.
And it is for just common people, too. We talk about, well, get away from it all, right? But, yes, environmental changes help. Definitely not all of it. I mean, hell, if you still listen to the same music, I say in the book that you could be leaving 0.01% of the cancer. You didn't remove it all. See, I say in the book, look, you got to be willing to change your hairstyle. Wear clothes you said you never would wear. Listen to music you said you hated. See, that's when I used to lose people. They'd go, what? No, not my hair, not my music, my clothes. So you want to change your life and you can't change a hairstyle? Well, we may have found something. So, you know, it was about finding some people were helped with steps. Some people were helped behaviorally. Some people were helped environmentally, right? Take all of what we know. So maybe that book, in a way, is written for the addict and all of us. Or the one even addicted to optimization. Because you don't have to be in a life transition and a shit to read this book. That's for sure. Please do if you are. But if you're not, and maybe optimization is your addiction or happiness, well, read it too, because it does the same.
So you have interviewed many, many fascinating people.
You being one of them.
Thank you.
Hence the interview. Thank you.
So over the course of your podcast, you've had a variety of guests from myriad backgrounds. And I'm not going to put you on the spot and ask you, you know, who is your favorite or best or so forth.
Dr. Maroon.
But I do want to ask you.
Kidding. I love you all.
To think about the really powerful transitional moments. Who has changed Adam Lowry's mind? Who's walked into the studio and met Adam Lowry who believed A and walked out of this studio and left Adam Lowry contemplating that possibly B might be correct? Share some of those moments with us.
Messenger. The messenger. Yeah. Big Mike, the messenger. Yeah, that's the first person that comes to my head, without a doubt. But Steve's been on the show. Danny's been on
this show. This is Steve Stone.
Yeah, Steve Stone, the immortal. Yeah, he's always on the podcast.
Tell us about the moments of change. What are the ideas that people have compelled you to recast or reconsider? So
everything that most people see as the final product is probably Danny or Steve's idea. If it's a design of some kind or a preface or even a seed of an idea, it's probably one of those two. Steve is around a lot. Steve has planted many and many seeds that he is so patient that he'll plant it and he'll deal with me. Like last night, we did 2 hours on a fucking banner, right? Well, we went right back to his original idea, but he fed me. You know what I mean? He's like, okay. Here you go. You want it? Okay. Here. And he was even ready to print what I wanted. And then I asked him, like I always do, what do you think? And I'm like, all right, just do that. I can see him at his house going, what the fuck? You know, so Steve's been very influential in a lot of it. So I say he's the cornerstone to this. And Danny actually had a conversation with me one day.
I'm sorry, this is Danny.
Danny Mac, Daniel McNamara. He's been on the show a couple of times. He's the producer of the show, too, with Steve. They both, you know, I think they really just tame or work me. So they really produce the show.
So I want to push you a little bit here, because you're focusing in on personality.
Well, I'm telling you a moment when he was talking to me.
Okay. Yeah. Go ahead.
Because I remember it. I'm kind of going through my Rolodex for old people. You know, we know what that means. For young kids, that's an old paper thing that had sorted ideas. Let me see. So, moments. So, yeah, he was talking to me that day, and I didn't know where to take the podcast, which I find myself at a lot many times. Steve goes, just keep doing what you're doing. Just shut up, you know? And I'm like, I got to do something different. I'd do something different all the time if I could. So, yeah, they tame it. So I was – this is before we changed it, like episode – when the elephants got the butterfly ears, that's when this conversation with Steve – it was a transition of conversations with Mike, the messenger, Steve, and Danny. And this time on the phone, I was like, dude, I don't know where to take this show. You know, I did this. I did that. We had a growth, but slow. You know, I'm like, I'm not even feeling it, you know. He reminds me to have fun. Steve's like, it only gets tough and shitty when you stop having fun. And he's right. It reminds me to have fun and follow what I feel. Danny goes, you know, Adam, what I'm missing in the podcast is I know that you're a fucking therapist, at least by training. I'm not a therapist now, technically, by name. I can't say that per se, right? So, but that's what he's saying. And he's like, I don't talk to anybody else but you. And there's probably a list of 25 men out there going, yeah, me too, that are listening to this podcast. Because I talk to all of them, you know, and I give them an hour randomly through days a lot. And like Mike has done for me, Steve does for me. So there's men that do that for me, you know, and we reach out. But Danny is one of the few. He was my business partner in the nightclub days too. So he's been with me a long time. He's seen a lot of things. Danny was my first friend of my exit from the dope game, but that's another story. So he'd been around a long time, and Danny knows how to elegantly tell me that I'm wrong and to do something different and better than this, and usually offers something to do without, he knows how to feed the lion, you know what I mean, he knows how to feed the bear. And he goes, I'm just missing it. I don't see it. I don't see that helper. I don't see the therapist in you. I don't see the, when you dive in, you know, I'm seeing an interview. And he's like, there's a million people doing interviews, Adam. Do something they can't do. The reason I call you. And I'm like, yeah, yeah. I mean, at the time I'm on the porch, right? I'm hanging up the phone like, fuck yeah, that's it. That's the new mission, right? And Steve had been cultivating a direction. They're all pointing the same direction. And Steve's over here all the time. So he's just in my ear. It's difficult to point out a one time with Steve. I can point out where he was standing. And multiple conversations, you know, the most influential one was he was at the bar here facing me and I was in the kitchen. And anyway, the elephant grew butterfly ears to symbolize a transition had happened. We probably won't stay with the same logo as we develop because it's transitioning. It's changing. Just like I say in the book, life is changing. So we have to adapt principles to modify that approach of life. Be willing to change and flow with that river, not fight the currents of.
So you advocate on the one hand for people to go ahead and really take seriously radical change, change the people, change the music, change the hair, change the clothes, change everything. And on the other hand, you yourself have found a path into your optimal experience without changing everything. So you seem to go through transformational moments or transformational seasons, but then you come back to some of your familiars, to friends and places and experiences that are meaningful to you. Yeah. How do you find a way to balance being genuinely authentic in this space of personal optimization, clean, healthy living, honoring your mind, your body, and your belief system, while also having ties that you seem to advocate other people should cut? Or sort of more simply, how would you share with someone else how they can find a balance between the really intensive change work of letting go,
sure,
and the holding significant and gorgeous familiars?
Well, first, I am no master at any of those. If I was, I would have wrote a different book. And if it was the right way, there wouldn't be so many books. That's what I like to say. If there's one way to relationship, there's a lot of books on it. You know, so it's the same with self-help and self-empowerment. But I think those are those authentic paths that we take. And by no means do I say I'm 100% authentic. And you ask me how. I talk a lot. I write a lot. I share a lot. The microphone was a rebirth. Now, the seasons of change. I talk in the book that when you're trying to make a drastic change in your life, whether it's a drastic optimization or a serious change from a transition, you have to cut those things. My cancer reference that I referred to in the book earlier is if you had a cancer tumor, you wouldn't say, hey, doc, before you take this out, make sure you leave 0.01% of that in there, would you? No, you wouldn't. Well, that song that you play on Friday night, that could be it. You know what I mean? That shirt you put on, that place you go, those friends you call. You can't risk any of it. I even use what I call the rule of two. Two songs removed, two people removed, two places removed, they go to. All of it. You have to clear the belief canvas. You're too vulnerable at the time. So, but that's if you're in that place that you need to. But I also say that they can come back. Because I was referencing that part in the book when I came back to Orlando. I came back because you have to visit to show you that the places, you take a little spot out of exposure therapy and behavioralists here, not cognitive. Cognitive will come with the exposure behavioral experience. Because I say that thoughts change beliefs and experiences, but so can behavior. That when you manipulate a different behavior, a different experience can also change your feeling. So you can attack it from both sides, thoughts and behavior. You know, and experience, you can change the feeling. So coming from both sides, you have to revisit them. And when you can change the perception of what it was to what it is. See, I reference Haystack a lot when I talk about music. And a lot of people look at me like, are you kidding me? And they listen to him and what? One of the first white rappers to ever hit the scene. Long, long time ago, way before Eminem or anybody else hitting the scene. And he spoke about the life I lived. He wasn't a backpack rapper. He talked about the dope game, etc. But he would write stories and moments in other people's lives sometimes. And some of his songs would touch me. And it was his song that played at a few suicide attempts back then.
Of yours?
Yeah. I mean, I went as far as dressing up in my favorite suit, my black Cadillac I drove at the time, and drove down an old dirt road I was raised on. I thought this would be beautiful. But Haystack happened to be playing, and it would be the song that just happened to come on. It'd be that right one. Maybe My First Day was one of them.
And but, so you exist as a part of a collective that we like to refer to as I Am the Evidence people. You are someone who has experienced what we can easily call radical trauma, tremendous trauma in your childhood.
Perception.
Perception at different points. And yet you sit here today, a loving husband, a loving father, living your passionate dreams, a life that you are fully invested in, embraced, and engaging every day. Can you take a moment and talk to those people who are listening, who are in the middle of not knowing how to let go of some of what they perceive as trauma, what they perceive as pain, some of those people who are still doing the dance between living and dying, which we call suicidal ideation, of people who are doing the dance between living and dying, which we call walking the road of addiction. What do you say to those people who are living in the spaces that you have come out of, transformed yourself out of? What do you say to them to help them come through out onto the other side?
That's tough advice. I know what I'd say. And the that's tough advice to sneak in the back window on that question. To finish that closing thought of the environments and that music influence, like I said, eventually it comes back because you have to listen to the song and change the perception. So for me, rather than listening to that song now, I had to remove it from my life for a while. But when I listen now, like when I revisit Orlando, I could say, man, that was that time I was suicidal. That was scary. Like someone may listen to an old relationship song. I can't hear that song. That was our song. So they ripped a song out of their life. Something that moved them at one point. But now when I play these things or go back to those places or whatever, I smile because I go, that's a place I came out of. And then when I listen to the lyrics, I hear, yeah, man, you know, rather than the pain of it, it's the triumph of it, maybe. And so in the book, I say that you can bring those back into your life, you know, eventually when you're ready to change the perception. And that's where people struggle. And so for the people in the trauma, the place you have to start is what you believe. What you believe it was supposed to be, or what it could have been, or what it should have been, what it did to you. And we can focus on scars of things. We can focus on the wisdom that comes from those scars. But sometimes we can be so tuned in to being mad at ourselves that we didn't catch it, that we didn't see it sooner, that only if... Well, if you can believe the fact that there is no truth and there is no reality, and what you create is your truth, is your perception, then that trauma that you experience, I would tell you, or you maybe could argue to yourself, the trauma is not even real. It's battle preparation. It's preparation for what it is you're supposed to do, maybe. Or how you're supposed to help somebody else. Because maybe the trials we come through, you're still here. You're still standing there, which tells me you were victorious from that battle, from that trauma, because you've made it. So yeah, I'm going to tell you, you've made it. Maybe not in your head, maybe not mentally, but that's a mere perception away. That's a moment away. That's a dialogue frame away. It's a belief away. To look at the trauma, you feel that may just bog down everything mentally each day and even physically and say, the perception of that has given me this wisdom, this way to help. I now have experienced things that I can help others with, that I can reach out to, because I think maybe the first step of trauma is A, changing the belief of it, moving to the perception change, focusing on that perception change, and using others, reaching out to them and going, how did you do it? How can I do it? How can we help others do it? And when you use that social connection too, there's power in that. When you can start with what you really believe about why you think leaving this planet is better. Somebody told me one time, I'll never forget, when I was going to leave this place, how do you know the other side's better? Hey, if you're willing to question that, it's a place to start. And so I'm going to use what Leo said, and I say it in the book, about your trauma. If I had person A, and I had person B, and both of them are you. I have you A, and I have B U. The A U has reached the point of happiness and success that you define, of whatever that is. And they've reached that with, you've reached it with a silver spoon. No adversity, maybe a little. You're generic. And you've made it to that point. Now the other you, the B, they've lived your life, experienced your trauma, been through your shit, and they've still reached that level of success and happiness. Well, then I ask you, who would you rather be?
Right.
And in the book, I say, well, be you. So hopefully you can be you. And that's the perception change, that those things built that respect. And who would you respect more? Somebody that makes it, that had no shit? Do you really? Because when you do see those people that make it, per se, and they haven't been through anything, what do you say? You tell them, well, they haven't been through shit. They ain't seen what I've seen. Well, that means when you make it to that point, the respect is that much higher. So thank God that you've been through the shit you've been through. And until you can face the fear, that fact, that moment, that point, that reality that you can shape, that thank God I experienced that trauma. Now, that's tough for people to say. But for me, that's not powerless. I'm not going to step in the ring with the biggest fear of my life, the biggest fight of my life, and say I am powerless to do nothing. Nah. I can do it. I can change it all. I change the perception. I change the thought. I can shape my environment to help shape what I believe and what I feel. You can do that. That's the power of you. And it starts with the perception. So to answer your question, that's what I would tell them. Whew.
So you are getting ready to go on a tour to bring this message.
Got me all shaky, man.
Yeah, that was quite the role you got on.
I mean that shit.
And it's a much needed one.
I mean that shit, man. I think I was just entertaining back in the day. I mean that. And I start getting shaky because there's people out there I know. I even tear up for them a little, you know what I'm saying? They've been there. Proceed.
So you're getting ready to go on tour and bring this work, this message, this voice out to the many.
Yeah, we are. Sir, whoo, woosah, bring it back one. All right, yeah, we are. We've been diligently working.
Where are people going to be able to find you? What are the highlights?
We leave Friday. Friday, I'll be in Tampa.
Can you give us the date on that?
Yeah, that is April 15th, I'll be in Tampa. Oh, man, did you hear the radio voice guy kick in all of a sudden? April 15th, I'll be in Tampa, and I'll be premiering on the F&K podcast with Chris Fisher. No, but I'm going to go down there. He's one hell of an interviewer, Chris Fisher. He has been in radio for almost 20 years. His voice on radio is how he talks in real life, and it's fucking awesome. But I'll be in Tampa on Friday. That Friday, we'll also be broadcasting from a Fort Lauderdale podcast, Jeremy Pound's podcast, called The New Customer Machine. I suggest any business person, self-branding person, anybody that wants to grow a brand or an idea or a thought, listen to that podcast. Jeremy's, in a way, kind of been the pinch hitter a lot in this, too. I ask him some advice on marketing, promotion stuff. He's a great guy. Been on the show. So I'll be down on his podcast on Saturday. That's the 16th. Sunday, I'll be in Naples on ESPN Radio. Shout out to Brett Richard and Project Fit Radio. Fit Project Radio. Sorry, buddy. Fit Project Radio 99.3. I'll be on the radio down there Sunday, back up to Orlando. Then we leave on Monday to be in Jacksonville. So we'll be in Jacksonville April 18th. We'll be in Atlanta April 19th. We'll be in Nashville on 420. We will be in D.C. on 421, meeting up with Lee Camp and the Redacted Tonight crew. Then Philadelphia on Saturday, New York for 2 or 3 days, Boston for a day or so, and then a secret broadcast location on the 28th. Yes, the book and tour podcast. That's what we're doing. I mean, yeah, there's a couple of highlights. We got a music podcast planned up in Nashville. That'll be fun. Tatum Knox is the competence cultivator on a competence page for us. That'll be premiering soon. He's been on the show, too. But he's got a nice event planned for us up there. A lot of things we can't talk about. Some cool things. Some could be awesome. We'll see. But he manages a couple country music artists up there. And they'll be there. I'll be interviewing them, talking to them in a large group. That ought to be fun. But we have interviews set up with professors from various schools, from here all the way to New York, to the random person that I'm going to interview and talk to. And so while we're on tour, what Steve carefully worked with us yesterday is what we're asking people to do is if you catch us on tour, if you see us and you're driving next to us and you can see the signs and you're reading them, take a picture of you, hashtag it with the TCR tour, and you'll join us. We'll see you. You'll tag. You'll take a picture in front of the signs. Take a picture in front of the book. Send it up. Just join the tour with us, and I'll talk about you on podcasts, etc. That's the tour. Yeah, get in there. You know, getting in. I've been all over social media doing this to grow this. It's been a great seed, but it's time to get in the trenches. It's time to get with the people, to talk to the people in the faces, get their feedback. You know, get in it. It's that time again. The bear's done hibernating. It is.
Now, your tour is going to be doing double duty, and you are going to be also doing some film production on your upcoming documentary, Chemical Incarceration. Is that right?
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Oh, you like the camp? Yeah. The chemical incarceration. Oh, yeah. We are going live, so put the camera just on me, brother, if you can. I'll cover. So chemical incarceration actually comes from. That's the activist movement, essentially. That's what started this. Those were the atrocities that I was witnessing, that I was watching. The name kind of came from Dr. Rybeck was talking about it one day, and then Danny and I were discussing a film. Danny, who I've already referenced on the podcast, he's a filmmaker, producer. His first feature film, actually, Literature to Larceny, is coming out soon. You can view the trailer to literaturetolarceny.com. So his movie will be out, but he also did his first movie, Red Tide. This will be his first documentary. And so him and I have gotten together on this, and the trailer will be out probably in about a week or so. And this was the second book that I referred to when I was on Rogan's podcast, which is, it's more like a manifesto. It's a writing of my experiences within the rehab world, if you will. And I mainly speak from a Medicare-funded, Medicaid-funded place. There's tons of private rehabilitation programs that are outside of that. So I'm talking about the blue-collar, poverty-stricken people that need help. And that's what I witnessed. And, you know, the chemical incarceration is labeled there because it's two fronts. The people showing up for help are what I guess the social construct would define and the DSM would define as dependent or addicted. So they're showing up there to get off of drugs, and they're put on drugs. And I said drugs again. They're showing up there to get off of scheduled substances that are causing effects in three phases of their life and have sought help. And then we help them by replacing those substances with other synthetic substances. And many times we save lives. I don't want to knock it. You know, it's better than someone ODing, you know, I'm all for that. But to really change, why risk it? You know, you can get off of certain things. So for me, it was prescribing one chemical for another. And this became almost incarcerated because then the patients needed their meds as bad as they needed whatever they were supposed to get off of. And they're just as expensive, if not more. Then we'd ask people to stop selling drugs when they have to make the money to pay, right? So it's about that. And a lot of people, shout out to Chris Bell, who did a great documentary called Prescription Thugs. And, you know, the OxyContin Express was another one. These are two great documentaries that literally changed some direction.
And Chris Bell has a quote that you reference in your book, right, where you say, if it's got a commercial, you shouldn't be eating it.
Yeah, no, he says, when's the last time you saw a commercial for a pineapple? You know, he's like, you just don't, right? And he leads into saying that, right? So, no, but Chris and OxyContin Express were our two prescription thugs just came out not too long ago, January 22nd. It's on iTunes and stuff. But it really took a closer look at the pill operation of it, how the drugs are, where they come from, and a look also at some of the treatment opportunities of it. And Chris, during the making, got affected, if you will. He was affected by addiction during the making of the film and got treated, etc. So, but these two films really brought to light the chemical side of it, right? So by chemical incarceration, we're just saying that we know this exists. It's becoming aware by huge voices now that this is an issue. You know, it's an epidemic spreading. And all we really know about help for it is what we watch on Intervention, and I'm speaking in the GU, the general U, the masses. What we understand to be the cure for this pill epidemic is interventions and rehab, which I worked in, which I'm going, oh my God, right? So I'm going, how is this connecting? And so as I got further into it, what we found is there's a model called the Florida model, which is a practice of synthetic substitution and et cetera. It's deep. Look up the Florida model. But we found the creation of the Florida model, how it was created, why it got created, why the state of Florida. And we focus on the process of the treatment and point out this is what happens. And so when I say addicted to the process, you're a behavioralist in a way, social scientist. You understand how people operate. That's your field. See if we're onto something. So what we say by addicted to the process, what do people say when they come to rehab? Well, I'm addicted to the drugs. So for me, you're addicted to a sore throat, but I know you got the flu. You see what I'm saying? You're affected by a sore throat, you're telling me, but I know you got the flu. So what treatment is offered outside, especially to the low socioeconomic demographic?
Well, so we have this prison system of treatment, if you will, where people are going, you know, from zone one to zone two to zone three to zone four, and, you know, can end up sort of being lifers.
But what's the alternative? The alternative for them
Well, this is what I want to ask you to talk about, you know, coming all the way back into the rat maze.
Which we never explained.
You did do, I thought, a fairly...
not the rat park part. Just
the rat park, right.
Just the dying rat park.
Go over the park section of it, if you could.
All right. Really quickly, you'd have to tell me the researcher, the person, but I'm not good with the book part, right? No, but the researchers put together, what they did is build a Disneyland for rats, if you will. Every toy and thing you could think of that they could play on, huge, amazing, awesome cage that if it was bigger, you would play in. And then they put a bunch of rats in there for socialization. Then they put access to cocaine, same they did the rat. What was the percentage? 1%, 2% would use?
I don't have the percentages.
It's small. 1% to 2% would use, but then eventually some would acclimate back in. They would come in and out. So when there was things to do, a structured social environment, well, no one died. Amazing.
And this is where I want to pick up with you, and this is where I want you to kind of open up. We've talked quite a lot about your book, some of your upcoming projects, and I want to take some time now for you to really start being able to deep dive into a more global social framework.
Let's go. I like it.
So understanding that ultimately, addiction is based in a sense of dissatisfaction. We're not grabbing for more, 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 and we're not grabbing for use, use, use when we are, you know, in a state of like beautiful calm and wonder and fulfillment and exuberance and joy. We're not needing all these other things. But maybe when we look out,
I'd argue
these are the moments to spar, you know, and so I will roll it out for you, and then you can spar back with me, because this is where you're, you know, really articulating where you're coming from and where it's at is going to unfold.
You know what? I misunderstood where the question was going. That's what I didn't realize. And now I'm starting to, when you said globalization, I was expecting this. Global change.
I was pulling global from the business sector, where we mean like a whole, a whole sphere of it.
Way my fault. A little presumptuous, Adam. Slow down on the trigger.
So we have populations that are being bombarded with the visual and the tactile aversion of salt and sugar. Right. And so in our human palate, we're hardwired to love the taste of sugar and love the taste of salt. And some would argue this is why it's rare in nature, so that we can't overwhelm our systems with it, because we have a tough time stopping.
Sure.
But we're at a state in society where we've got, you know, just so much provocation to wealth, to sexual beauty, to all kinds of desire and want and hunger, and I need that, and it's all comparative based, you know. So you can't really be 13 years old and not have a sense of what a very handsome boy or a beautiful girl or a talented singer or an exceptional artist. There's nowhere to hide from what the culture's constant. You know, call to extreme materialism, extreme visual delight. And so when people are surrounded by all of these triggers to feel dissatisfied in their own life, when they see so much really interesting drama going down onto, drama is exciting. Even when it's painful, it's exciting, you know. Mm-hmm. So they see all of this going down and happening around them. What's the invitation? What's the gain? What's the benefit to doing all this really difficult work to just live in balance when people are surrounded by sort of a rat park gone mad, if you will, that's actually compelling them to want to take the drugs as opposed to pulling them away from the drugs? How do practitioners like yourself gain a foothold in that kind of a field?
Ooh, wow. 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 So the original question that I got, the last question is, how do we gain a foothold in a field of psychological attack of a Disney World gone mad, as you say?
Yeah.
And what was some of the lead into? It was beautiful. I like the question. It was kind of two parts, right? I want to make sure I got your whole question understood.
I think we can start there and then fan out. So I think the first part, you know, was the section that you were not wholeheartedly agreeing with, which is, you know, what is the source of addiction itself? And I suggested that it has some basis in a sense of dissatisfaction.
Okay. Yeah. Now I connect the two. Thank
yes.
you.
Yes.
Yeah. I would argue the fact that all addiction is based in some dissatisfaction. I think that's a little presumptuous for lack of research. Yes, we can say that a lot of people involved in addiction have been involved in trauma. Yes, huge percentage. And I'm one that spouts for that. I'm a huge percentage person who spouts for the idea that, you know, again, the addiction, again, is the symptom. More than likely, you know, there's a trauma embedded in there. So that's you, like a practitioner, you know, would go for, like a doctor would go, well, let's go for the basics. Let's test for this, and then work you all the way up. So as a practitioner for the foothold, you have to kind of work that way. And so you got to maybe say, is there trauma here? Because it's a high percentage. But we find trauma so much, I think. And again, this is all wrapped in perception. So when you take a social norm or a social construct and you form an idea of what addiction is defined as, well, by the DSM, it has to affect your biopsychosocial, your biological, your psychological, and your social before you classify it as dependent. So that's still a social construct. Dr. Carl Hart talks against that social construct, right? Of, well, what is the addiction part? You know, how do you work in thereby defining what addiction is? And that's Roxy, by the way, going nuts. And so I think the further we can get away from treating symptoms of anything is a start of a foothold. So it becomes a question of perception again. So remember back to the core beliefs. If we talk about what do you believe about the world, others, and self, if your belief about the world is this is a Disney World gone mad, well, then in that belief, you will treat the world accordingly. And any beliefs that build on top of that belief that concern the world are going to come from that negative, irrational belief. Because a Disney World gone mad is a perception that we concrete to be a truth in our own life. Could that perception provide good for us? Sure, because we keep our defenses up. But is keeping our defenses up what we want to do? Is that how we stay open, as you say, and balanced? And one of the things I do want to get across is I say in the book, I'm not selling Zen here. This is not me going, find this place of balance of mind and body. And in this Zen state, you will find happiness. Okay. There's 30 million of people saying this. Okay. And yes, people find happiness this way. But what do you say to the optimizer who struggles to be happy in the now, why is always optimizing later? Can't find the nail, right? How do you work with that? Do you say change who you are? Do you say change how you believe? Do you change persons, places, things? Or do you find a way to cultivate that authentic self and allow the self to shape the environment? So then our perception of the environments we create are no longer a Disney World gone mad. I don't even like Disney. But yet a nature park that's free and open, full of everything and waterfalls, right? If we can perceive it as that way, because when I walk each day into this world, I used to wake up. I had to wake up. No. I must wake up ready. What I've been through, what I've seen, what I knew, that's my belief. I had to keep my guard up because that's what I believed about the world. So I wake up each day and go, what can I learn? Where's the competence? Where's the experience? Where's the moment? That's why I have trouble talking about football and the weather. Because I could die tomorrow, you know, and I want to experience it. You know, my native name was Little Bear, which has now been given 2 days ago to my daughter. She's inherited that name. And Little Bear was the native name first passed down until you passed, is because what the little bear would do on the farm is pull down the corn and tear it all up. Bears and everybody got along. We used to eat. Everybody was cool. So for me, when I wake up, I almost see life that way. But I'm learning to eat the whole piece of corn before I move to the next one too. And so when I wake up, I see the world as my cornfield, if you will, even though it's terrible for you. And try to eat it up. And it starts with competence, I think. It starts with, and competence can be boring and bleh to people, but competence really can be an experience, a moment, right? It can feed you and all those things. So it's not zen.
And
it's,
so you say that it is competence to confidence to enthusiasm.
Is a path to happiness.
This is your path. And then you describe...
Is a path to happiness.
You describe happiness as a state of cultivated enthusiasm, which I love. Yeah. Talk more about cultivating enthusiasm.
Well, I think a lot of words... First, I have to start that, you know, you got to believe that dialogue has meaning. Most people, when I start talking about this, start saying, oh, you're playing semantics. But if I remove or take one word out of something I'm saying to you, it can make you want to hit me or hug me. You know what I mean? So we know then to watch our words. But when we talk to ourselves, we rarely guide our words to what we say. Oh, God, I open up too many Pandora's boxes when I start talking. Help me, Steve. I told you I can't do this on my Steve. Your question again, preface to me one more time so we can connect.
Talking about the process of cultivating enthusiasm.
Yeah, because it links to so much for me, right? The whole book filters in my head of where to start. So enthusiasm many times is messed up. It's confused with passion or excitement even, right? I say in the trailer, if you've ever watched it, where it said you'll learn why passion isn't enough. People say you got to wake up and live with passion. Well, yeah. But passion is also that moment that it rushes you and you go, whoo. We like to say, I do it with passion. I'm going to say you do it with enthusiasm.
I think we all like to say that we do it with passion.
Right. But enthusiasm is more authentic and genuine because enthusiasm, I say in the book, the CCE principle, enthusiasm is built from true competence that leads to real confidence. Real confidence, in my book, the way I say it, that's funny, I can actually say in my book. In my book means you can argue both sides of the argument, not just one. You know both sides. This is a full confidence to me. And in that confidence grows enthusiastic sometimes. Just because you're confident about something doesn't lead to enthusiasm. You may be able to go, now that I know it, both sides, yep, yoga's not for me, right? You can do that. You can do it with exercise, life, friends, whatever. So that stage, it begins with an interest. You have a spark interest. You feed that interest competence. Competence is gained through experience. You experience it. You research it. You read it. You talk to people. You soak that up. You open yourself. You don't necessarily have to be, I know that. I know that. People love to tell you. Tell them something. Oh, I know. I know. I know. I know. No, don't know for a second. You know what I mean? So open and remember, all that begins with humility. The first principle back there is H equals C. So open yourself up to humility leads to competence. So humility equals competence. When you get an interest, you sniff it out. You seek it down. Chase the experience. Chase the competence. So you can be confident, maybe that enthusiastic state. I tell people to think about something that you're enthusiastic in doing, anything. How do you feel when you're doing it? Happy. There you go. It's a state, I think. It's a place. It's a state, right? I think it's, I can create, I can cultivate a state of happiness. Mm-hmm. I don't wait to find happiness. Again, go look in the mirror. There you are. Are you going to find, you got to watch what you say. The dialogue matters. Intentions matter more, but dialogue matters. So if we tell ourselves, you know, oh, I'm passionate. Well,
what is the difference between intentions and self-dialogue?
Well,
are you're not articulating intentions through the dialogue?
Well, a lot of times what our intentions are doesn't match our dialogue. The other day, I'm in the room with my daughter trying to tell her some things, being daddy. Something comes out of my mouth that I go, Dah, that's not my intention. My dialogue sounded very authoritative. You know what I mean? That's not how you coax a 16-year-old, by the way, people. Okay? Authority does not work. You'll see. No, so, and then I realized, but my intentions were to guide and help and love. But my dialogue didn't match my intention. So when we throw off, you're just playing wordplay, Adam, when you say whether you're doing this, excitement, passion, whatever, you can say that. But they have definitions. And when we say words, definitions pop. We move. And based on these pictures, so when people say an addict, right? I'm going to circle back to that. When they say addict, We have certain pictures in our mind, definitions. So when I use I am, I start to become this definition. So you can become other definitions. You can filter through them. You can use them. And those come through following interest. You get a little interest. You get a little thing in. The back part of your question, you asked me, how do people stop being addicted? I was moving from the not everybody's been through trauma. And I'll back that up with a little, I don't know, metaphor. You've all seen the 3 or 4 or 5 year old, 7 year old, whatever. Hell, 34 year old, I've done it, right? They just spin around in circles till they fall down. They do it again. They do it again. You got to tell them to stop. They flip their eyelids over. They cross their eyes. Uncle throws them dangerously 38 feet in the air, right? Catches them and they're like, do it again. Do it. Throw me in the pool. Right. They want this. Well, what are they doing? Well, that's mood modulation. That's what that is. It's mood modulation as it's fine. So I'm modulating my mood. Look what we do as kids with little reward. Little reward. We crawl, right? We crawl. We crawl, crawl, crawl. And then we spend time trying to stand up and we fall. We fall. We bust our shit sometimes, right? Your dad's catching us. Mom's looking out if they're there, right? Otherwise, you're just falling, head trauma all over. God knows, right? For what? A foot and a half different change of perception? That's it. You're persevering before you even know what perseverance is. Why? Because the environment around you is walking, or because you like the view? Because you definitely don't get around better. You know, you see them little ones crawling, right? They're just they're like little pugs. But when they stand up, they're still struggling, but they maintain it. And so we modulate our mood. We look for new foods. We travel. We look for new experiences. Some of us. We test that out. And when you don't, after a while, we call it midlife crisis. I don't know. We buy Corvettes. We travel, right? That's what we do. When I think it's in our nature to mood modulate, to experience, to poke at, to feel, to little bear that shit, right? And so in that nature, addiction can take over because we chase supposed tos. We try to numb pain. Or we try to optimize the now. Because a lot of people that use supplements, drugs, caffeine, whatever, call it what you want, but you're mood modulating. Sex, mood modulation. Sleep, mood modulation. Don't sleep for 3 days. Yeah. So all of this is natural human mood modulation. Why? I don't know. We're naturally curious. What are we looking for? Why are we trying to go so fucking fast? I mean, these are questions that go in my mind all the time. Questions I never cared about. Why do you do what you do? Shit, I don't know. Well, because of them. Because of the past.
You tell people that in order for them to identify a life philosophy, they need to ask why. Of each of their beliefs, that they need to question the belief, write the belief down, and ask why.
See it. I believe. Look at that. It.
When does the why stop?
Should it?
And why does the why stop?
When do we stop changing? When do we stop growing? When we die, I think Lauryn Hill said. Or who was it? Who said that anything not living, anything not growing is dead? I think Lauryn Hill said that. Maybe somebody else. But it's in the book. So I'd ask that question. Right, we die. So when do we stop asking why? I don't know, maybe when you stop growing, when you stop changing. See, I refer in the book that one of the phrases I cannot stand these days, that's just who I am.
Duh. I wanna hold you on this why space for a moment. You know, it's really, I don't know if you're familiar at all with the work of Rabelais. I think that's how it's pronounced. My French is a little rusty here, so folks will forgive me. But in one of his books, he talked about the law of Thelema, where there's a land that has no laws. The only law is that there is no law.
We live in it.
I would suggest that that's not the case at all.
I mean, you got gravity, you have laws of physics, sure.
When you're suggesting that we can go forward with the why infinitely, you know, in truth, when we begin to do that, we are going to face some basic challenges in ethics, in laws of comportment, behavior, presentation of self. And so when we start to play this in the first couple of phases, I can see how it might be absolutely delightful. You know, there's a why suspension, you know, why must we wear clothes and why must we walk only that goes on at my alma mater, UC Santa Cruz, every year for the very first rain. The students ask, you know, why do we have to do any of these standard things? And they strip off all their clothes and run through the rain in enormous packs, whooping and screaming. And it's, you know, it's fantastic. It's outrageously fun, you know, to watch. I'm not a participant, but... And so so this first couple of layers, if we had, you know, millions, even a few billion people taking the why all the way out over and over and over, strip it down, strip it down, strip it out.
And I wonder what kind of political candidates we'd have.
If there really is, you know, really putting your philosophy down to the test.
Sure.
If there's no stop point. Mm-hmm. How do we then exist as a society in a space where people can have safety, where people can have satisfaction, where people can have any sense of the certitude that we need for our daily sanity to get through a regular day? If there's not going to be a stop any place, if you're really genuinely telling people, you know, keep pressing the go pedal and say, why? Yeah. Why this? Why that? Why this? So that they're in a state of never-ending personal deconstruction.
Mm. Personal evolution. Personal revelation. You have to... Destruction breeds darkness, but it also breeds...
Deconstruction.
Deconstruction can bring destruction.
Reconstruction.
But it also brings creation. So as you deconstruct...
So are you saying that you're an anarchist?
We could go a long time about that's just another label. I'm just me and my views, but well, first I would want to live there, whatever this place that we can develop where none of it, but first I'm having trouble correlating why simply asking yourself why about various components in life takes safety away. One, because you kind of preface the fact that how...
Can I give you a practical?
No, I'm going to get there. Okay. I got a lot of questions. You asked like four in that one. So I'm telling you, I struggle to where why asking why violates safety. One, I think I can answer that sort of by saying, well, if I have the perception of satisfaction as being a necessity in my life, if that's what I'm looking for is satisfaction, well, then I would say you arguably agree that we arrive at some point to some place. Then life becomes about the destination, not the journey, which I disagree. It's about the journey. To simply use Maslow and say, are we all supposed to self-actualize if we reach this point one day? My other posed question and response would be, well, how many times during one day do you ask, why do I have to do that? Why do I answer that? Why is the world like this anyway? So we ask, how many problems do you have in a given week? Until those stop, then I think we can stop self-analyzing and learn to self-actualize in moments. It seems to be that I don't like the word evolving, but we're always reaching, right? And maybe that's a human element. Maybe it's not where it comes from. But I think where people struggle, and I have, is that you can still be happy in the now. You can be happy in the now while optimizing that. Because we can optimize that. Remember, the happiness is a state, right? So we can be fulfilled in moments while searching for optimization, different ways, different experiences, growth ideas. So there is a place or a failsafe in the book that puts a stop to the one that may go too far down the rabbit hole. Remember, the second tool of change is the life philosophy. The first is RSA. So we learn how to...
And that's rational self-analysis.
That's right. We learn how to apply RSA, like you said, and go down the rabbit hole. But we only go down the rabbit hole of those components to change. First, your cores, the ones we've talked about, other, self, the world. Then we work into 10 components of change, down in nutrition, friends, environment. We work those. We apply it. Well, when you apply RSA, the last step of RSA is you will have constructed a new rational belief, right? Well, those sentences that you construct from your own thought, your own beliefs, that you reconstruct, will build your life philosophy, right? So what happens is I teach people that making choices becomes different. We're taught to make pros and cons, right? To think about it, to toil. Well, what this does, we become the human or the rat, where we seek the path of least resistance or we seek the path of most immediate reward. So give a rat or a human the opportunity to make a list to choose. Well, more than likely, we make emotional choices based on those rat principles. Yep, compared to a rat.
Right.
So how do we take the emotional intrusion out of the equation? Can I ask for advice? Sure. But if you look at building your life philosophy, your mentor's advice is built into the philosophy. So the way we make choices or the way we start to answer why when life makes us ask why, we don't go, why? Write it down. Why write it down? We've already done that. We simply refer to our life philosophy, read that to yourself, and that's your own advice to you. So if you choose not to pay attention to your own beliefs and advice, well, that's your choice. It's easy to say no to other people's advice. But when you've thoroughly thought out your philosophy, not emotionally moved on it, you've built it through RSA, well, then the why stops. Because your belief about the world is, I don't have to ask why. That's why I'm not going to hit that person. That's why I'm not going to steal from that person. That's why I'm not, because my belief about other self in the world is as follows. I don't have to toil, but what RSA can help you with are those moments when life doesn't give you a warning, when it just goes, boom, drama, shit, right? RSA teaches the pause. Listen to your thoughts. Don't just react. Pay attention. What am I saying? Pause for a moment. Apply RSA. You apply it to the components, but I tell you in the book, apply it to a fight with your spouse. Apply it to a driver cutting you off. Pause. What do I believe about this guy? Motherfucker, cut me the fuck off. Well, why do I believe that? Because I'm scared. Shit. I'm just scared. All right. Well, how can... Thank God he didn't hit my car. See, there's the reframe. Thank God he didn't hit... In a moment, you can construct new feelings. In a moment of thought.
I would be remiss if I did not ask you to spend some time talking about the very nuts and bolts practical revelations of the role that nutrition, exercise, and sleep play in making the transformation to a healthy existence possible. So we've spent a lot of time talking about the cognitive, thoughtful, mental side of things. It's been fantastic.
I feel guilty. I'm like, I'm not supposed to talk because I'm like, I'm guesting. Okay, I can ramble a little.
Yeah, it's been wonderful and really filling in so much of the philosophy, as well as again, these practical hands-on mental processes that people will be able to walk through as they go through each chapter of the Cognitive Rampage book. But right now, I want to pull you into a focus on these other three pieces. I believe you call it a trilogy.
A healthy core routine.
There's the healthy core routine and the need to have sleep. So, yeah. Talk to us about the realities of the limitations that are put on people when these elements are either missing or poorly tended, your sleep, your nutrition, and your exercise.
I would tell you that the other half of my book is then futile. That's how firmly I believe in that. If you don't apply those three.
The sleep, the nutrition, and the exercise. That's
right. If you don't start there. Don't get there, right? But at the same time, I think, it's so important. I mean, that's an influence. And one of the things I'm so tired of hearing is these motivational guys, you got to be willing to lose sleep to be successful or something. I say in the book, you got to be willing to get sleep to be successful.
I think Stephen Curry has actually gone on record saying that he's exponentially much more powerful on the court as a result of insisting on his 8 hours.
Yeah, there's tons of research. So in the book, I think I kept it to a paragraph. I think I say in the book, rather than give you all these facts and research, let me just try to scare you in one paragraph. And in one paragraph, I basically say you're a psycho. That's what happens. And without the sleep, well, you're not going to make good choices. Your body's not functioning. You're going to eat poorly, properly, quickly. improperly and quickly. It's not going to happen. And nutrition, the reason I didn't even go into it in the book, so don't worry. You're not going to buy the book and get a freaking nutrition lecture from me, okay? I promise you. What I visit in nutrition, exercise, and sleep is what you believe. Because many people, most of us, will eat right for a while, work out for a while, and then we relapse. We fail. And I say this because of what you believe. You know what you got to do, but you see how just knowing isn't that powerful. What you believe matters. So until you really know what you believe about food, nutrition, sleep,
right?
Until you know that, most people don't know what they believe. They know what they're supposed to do. I know. I eat. Right? You can hit the basics, right?
What is your counter for people who say, it's not cognitive. It's not about thinking. It's just about doing. You know, you need to put the bottle down. You need to stop drinking. Like, I don't care what you believe about drinking. You need to just stop drinking. You need to put the sugar down. Stop putting the sugar in your body. You need to start exercise. Just get up and move.
You might as well say.
What do you say to people who will tell you, and you will, and I know you're at the launch stages of this book, this work, bringing the message to the public, you're pushing back against a very entrenched tradition of you've got to do to make transformation happen. And you're saying you have to think to make transformation happen. You've got to change your thinking.
But I say
You say that thinking comes first.
Has to. Try to do an action and not think about what you're doing. Yeah. See, there's research, there's a book out called The Dance of Anger, and they talk about violence. And
that's Harriet Lerner.
And tells me
shout out to my anthropology people.
Well, they talk about how they did the study on abusers and whether they like to say when they lose their mind that I don't know what I'm doing when I go into this rage. But how do they know not to hit you square in the face? They know to shove you, right? It's because they come to find out they know exactly what they're doing. They think it. But it's easier to say, I don't know, it just overtook, it's rage, right? Well, it's the same idea to a behavioralist. How do you do without thinking about what you're doing? Now, you can do the reverse, but once you start to realize how powerful what you think is, then you can modify behavior as the second weapon you put into it. Because you do have to do to change. You do. But you can't just do if what you believe doesn't really believe you should be doing it, even though you know you should. Shooting all over yourself, right? So it's both doing, but you can only do genuinely and with follow through until what you believe has changed. If you operate on what you know, you will fail eventually. It'll work for a long time for people, but it fails. So what you believe matters, and you have to tap into that. You have to get into that idea. So, you know, for instance, an example, you ask somebody, well, what do you believe about food? You know, an answer is, I don't know, it tastes good. I don't know. See? Well, if you're walking around all day with the belief that food should taste good, and your body's been biologically programmed to fiend for carbs, sugar, and fake shit, it's what you believe. Ask a healthy person that's way into what they believe about food, like I did Brett Richard when I was down there. You know his response, food is fuel. That was the response.
Food is fuel.
Right? So that's
rest is fuel.
That's my philosophy too. So knowing is only half the battle. G.I. Joe was right. Knowing is only half the battle. What you believe is the other part. What you do is the other part. You know, I use in the book an example of how behavior can be just as powerful as thought. The day you wake up and go, I'm not going to the fucking gym today. I'm just not doing it. I'm not going to the gym or whatever it is you're not going to do. But you force yourself and you go. And at the end, you're like, man, I feel good. You get a physiological response. You get a mental response. You feel the reward. You've now taught yourself that pushing through thoughts returns reward with behavior. But then I circle back in the book and go, but how did you drive the car to the gym? You had to think yourself the directions to the gym. So you can behave all you want to without thought. I think they're called crazy, right? So when we learn that we operate on our thought, then I can modify thought to concrete behavior.
Well, it's wonderful. I know that we have a time limit in the cognitive rampage cave, but seeing as I have you in the interview seat today, which is a flip aside of where you usually sit, I can't close the broadcast out without asking you the pivotal question that you put to your guests. Adam, what is your life philosophy?
I believe the world to be an interconnected place of love, connection, and energy. And what you put in, you get back. Be careful what you put in because it does give back. Be careful of the places that you sit because they certainly give back. But make sure you give back. I've recited that many, many times with variations along the evolution way. Because remember, when you write the philosophy in the book, it doesn't stay that way. You change it based on lessons and what you learn. That last part, I'll never forget when I added it. When I say, remember, environments certainly give back. That was the lesson I learned my first 3 years working in the trenches of rehab. When it destroyed me. Like it destroyed me. It tore me apart. And I had to write on that philosophy about my environments, just like it says on there. I thought I was stronger. I went in ready and knowing, powerful. It beat the shit out of me, which I went back. I went back and won, right? But that time it beat me up. So I had to remind myself, be careful of where you sit because the environment certainly give back.
And again, the book is The Cognitive Rampage, A Dose of Authentic Revelation by Adam Lowry.
You get the limited edition.
You can get it on Amazon.
The limited, they can't anymore.
You cannot get the limited on Amazon, but you can go on to cognitiverampage.com. Adam, thank you so much for having me as the host today. It has really just been a privilege and a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you. Is it weird I feel guilty that I talk too much? Is that weird? You're the doctor.
I'm not that kind of doctor.
I know. I'm just saying. Yeah, I'm like, because I usually on my podcast, the challenge for me is to shut up and listen. That's the test I put to myself, and I fail it almost every podcast, like I'm now. And so it felt odd.
To be able to be the subject of the interview instead of the questioner.
Yeah, and allowed to just go, which is rare.
Well, I think that your audience will greatly appreciate having had this opportunity to get a greater understanding of your philosophies, your ideas, your framework, and also getting some really good insights into what they can expect when they read and use the Cognitive Rampage book. So thank you.
Thank you for extracting it from me. It's difficult for many people to do. I too can put up my defenses and boundaries and walls. So I think it takes a special connection to talk to people and I don't bring out the marrow in their perceptions. So thank you for doing that. I think you probably make me sound a lot smarter than I am.
Take care.
Oh, that's the exit. We're still live, right?
Yeah.
You know what? You know what I would like? Can we do something on the fly?
Yeah, we're still live.
You know what
Hello
I'm going
to
do?
Hello to the Namaste Nation.
What we usually do, right? You know what I do is we'll end and the guest is here and I'll go into my own zone and I close out. I go into my rampage at the end because
yes.
The guest usually leaves. So the guest is going to leave and close out.
This is like an impromptu, the host shall be the rampager.
Okay, close that on your perception.
Take care.
All right.
Interview anyway. Addictive Podcast, 3 p.m.
Yes, tune back in for the Addictive Podcast at 3 p.m. And in the meantime, just a reminder to all of you who have taken the time to listen to these many hours and who go about taking the time to listen to many hours in other frameworks, application is always in your hands. You can get all of the knowledge and information imaginable. We live in an astonishing age of data freedom. You have greater access to data than any generation in human history. But none of that is meaningful without practice, application, and use. Don't be afraid to start over every single day. Don't be afraid to not know what you're doing. Don't be afraid to try something new. And most importantly, even if you are afraid of all those things, go ahead and do it anyway, because your life is expecting you to show up.